process.
What I'm hoping is the beginning of the end. Colleagues, you are aware that we are here today and we are here tomorrow, and we will be in the National Assembly on Friday to deliberate on public input received from roughly 35 stakeholders. Thereafter, the committee will retreat into its corner and process submissions, and hopefully present a bill to the National Assembly for its consideration and adoption. That's the roadmap. Members will have, and our colleagues will have, the program for the day. We're hoping to be done by lunchtime, so we haven't provided for lunch, unfortunately. By lunchtime we're back. Members of Parliament know that there's a three-line work at 2, so we should be done by lunchtime. And we will introduce each other in a minute, just so that we know who is here and who isn't here. But before we do that, for the record, honourable members, of those that we invited over the next 3 days, we received an apology from the public protector. And the rationale, or the reason, is that they have been summoned to appear before the Committee on Justice and Correctional Services. That clashes with this meeting, and that's where they are. So they are hoping that we will consider their written submission and, where necessary, incorporate them. We've also received an apology from the Western Cape Government Ministry of Finance. And the reason being that the budget office, or following the budget address, Dr. Mayor will be attending standing committee meetings in the legislature and therefore can't participate in our hearing on the 7th or the 9th. So that is also, I guess, beyond their control. And the final one we received was from IRBA, that's the regulatory body of auditors, I think. And they are unable to attend. We firmly support the objectives of the bill. However, there could be a few challenges, so they're asking us to consider their report. So those are the three apologies, honourable members, today. And as apologies are received, we will indicate. What we will not do, though, is stop the process, because South Africans can't participate. We will then take the written comment. That's what will happen. So we've received those apologies. We're about to begin, and we're going to begin with accountability now. But before we do that, maybe we should, as soon as people have settled down, introduce each other so that we know who we talk. Because the Parliament has lots of seats this time. But there's no hierarchy or sitting arrangement, but there are seats here. And if we then could start with you, Advocate Hoffman, and you just go down there and introduce yourself. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. I'm one of the directors of accountability
now. Lawson Naidu from CASAC.
Good morning, Chair and honourable members. I am Dr. Tommy from Corruption Watch.
Good day, Ms. Alfama from the
Good Today is our final conference of the evening. I'm not the second of the project of Dr. Mayer, but I'm in the same.
Okay.
Good morning.
Does that mean that you will actually want to start to present?
No.
Sorry, just observe.
We have to submit comments to the my comments are open in the back.
Good morning. Also from the Western Cape Government, my name is Shanae Kenya. I am in legislation and I'll be observing the proceedings together with my colleagues.
I'm Arnold Cullen, I'm from the Auditor General. I serve liaison with the Standard Group in Auditor General, someone we should know.
Morning, Penny Ramojisi from the Auditor General.
Morning, Linda Lerouf from the Auditor General.
Yeah, from Scott Beck, Auditor General.
Hi, good morning, members and guests. My name is Kimi.
Good morning, Chair. I remember. My name is Eugene Zungu. I'm the National Leader Audit from the Office of the AG.
Good morning, Chair and everyone. Marissa Besteiner from Corporate Legal in the AG's office.
Good morning. Audrey Antoretra from Legal Services, Auditor General.
Good morning. Pumulene Rabonda from the Auditor General.
Good morning. Fatima Ibrahim, Parliamentary Legal Advisor.
Good morning, Daksha Kassin, Parliamentary Legal Advisor.
Good morning, Colin Simka, Colonel Advisor of the Committee.
Good morning, Samuel Hekiso, a researcher for the Committee.
Good morning, Chair. Madala Ntombela, Member of the Committee.
Good morning, I'm Deborah Carter, Member of the Committee.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Alan McLaughlin. I'm also a member of the committee.
Good morning. My name is Vincent Smith.
Good morning. My name is Sharon.
Thank you very much, honourable members. Now that we all know each other, let us start. And by way of opening comments, honourable members and colleagues, and in the interest of ensuring that we don't have a talk shop or talk for talking sake, as we normally do in this committee, let us indicate that we considered all the inputs from our stakeholders, and thank you very much. They were varied and they touched almost everything. So we considered it on Friday, and as a committee we went through the comments, afford you an opportunity to raise those issues and to be able to defend or to be prepared to defend them. To be prepared to defend them if you so desire, but just to indicate there probably are two main areas that we picked up. The one major one was the issue around whether it's desirable for the AG to be a debt collector, as the bill unintended consequences, or even maybe intended consequences. And we deliberated on it at the committee on Friday, and we tend to agree with fellow South Africans that the AG shouldn't be a debt collector, that we should find another mechanism. And we're raising it so that when you raise it, you can further criticize us. Our gut feel was that the accounting authority must be responsible for collecting the debt. In other words, AG will say, from my interaction operations audit, I've picked up 5 million rand that has been misappropriated or whatever the case might be, and it's been done by Vincent Smith. Mr. Minister, go and collect that money from Vincent Smith. And Vincent Smith then collects the money, and Vincent Smith is duty bound to honour the Auditor General's instruction. As as opposed to the AG going to collect the money being a debt collector. That was our initial thinking. So as you go around, you either criticize it, strengthen it, rubbish it. That's what it's about. That's what this is about. So that was the main area. The second area was around what I would call, for want of a better word, referrals. Now, there was, again in the Act, or the bill that was sent for comment, I think an understanding that the AG would go and do his work from his sample, identify potential or real misgivings in a specific area, whether it is access or bank recon or whatever the case might be. And his sample would pick up that he can quantifiably identify 5 million rand that was misappropriated. However, because it was only a sample, there is a potential that it could be 50 million rand. But because he hasn't had the time, he hasn't done it. Now, initially we said, well, okay, AG, what do you do is then you take that whole thing to the Hawks or to whoever, ask them to do that investigation, draw up a memorandum of understanding, and after a year they come back, or after a month they come back and say, indeed, it's not 5 million, it's 50 million rand, and we take it from there. Your argument was that, but if you do that, first of all, what guarantee do you have that this other agency would do what you want them to do? And then secondly, there's going to be an accountability challenge, that the AG should be a Chapter 9 institution. That was the flavor of your argument. Again, we considered it, fought about it, argued about it, and we really, at the end of the day, came up with maybe what you could call a two-pronged solution. That, take the scenario that I've raised. The Auditor General goes, and out of his sample, he picks up quantifiably that water was sold at an extended, or to call it an exaggerated rate, and he can quantify 5 million rand. And that was done by CFO. We are saying that he should then go and, this thing that we call a certificate, certify the 5 million rand and ask the accounting authority to collect it from the CFO and whoever else does it. Phase one. Phase two, go to the relevant authority, be it the Hawks, be it the public protector, and say, you know, I picked up 5 million from my limited sample, but it could be 500 million. Could you do the rest? And having referred it, that agency then does what it does. Does the investigation go to court or do whatever the case might be without the necessity to come back to the Auditor General? So that was what we were thinking about, and we were hoping that that would then satisfy your concern about the independence of the Auditor General and or the lack of productivity or will or whatever you call it from the other agency. So the Auditor General will go and say, I have, and I can prove a 5 million rand, Mr. Accounting Authority, no, Mr. Political Executive Authority, go and collect that money. Because he can take that to court if necessary, and he can defend it, he's got evidence. The rest he gives to the Hawks, to the SIU, and to everybody else. So those were the initial thoughts that we put on there. And we were hoping that as we go around, including the AG, we had asked your staff to also hear what we are saying. So that when you get a chance later on, you either support the committee's view, or you reject the committee's view, or you strengthen the committee's view. And of course there were others, but those are the two major areas that we thought that we would bring to your attention so that you strengthen what our thinking is, and hopefully once we're done with it, we're done with it. We're not going to revisit it for the sake of revisiting. That's really the intention. But if you want to challenge it and talk to it, you can do so. I'm hoping, honourable members, that I've covered accurately our discussions on Friday. Having said that, let us kick off and do the work of the day. We've given you, Advocate Hoffman, 15 minutes to deliberate, give us your views. We've got the submission, honourable members. And after 15 minutes, we will then challenge you, sir. Ask questions of clarity, do whatever we need to do, and hopefully we will have a better bill after our interaction with you and everybody else. It's 20 past almost. By watch, can we agree that about 25 to 10, we will ask you to stop and we open it up to members. Thank you very much, sir. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members.
Sorry. Simply indicates that honourable members in submission 3 in your pack. So if you go to submission 3, you should find the same category.
Thank you, Chair. I think this bill is a bit like the curate's egg. Remember that the curate was given an egg that was good in part, bad in part. Because of the time constraints and because of the role of the civil society organisations before this committee, I'm not going to take any time on the good parts, and there are good parts of the bill. Instead, I'm going to address three broad themes. The first one is, what is the mischief that the controversial part of the bill is aimed at? The second is the general legal and constitutional context in which the bill has to be considered by the committee. And the third is the specifics which are in our written submission and which I will not traverse individually in view of the time constraints. But let's get going with the first. I think that it is clear to members that there are two forms of mischief that is being addressed in the bill. The first is malfeasance in the public procurement process, which the Auditor General audits on an annual basis. When I say malfeasance, I'm talking about illegal activities that carry a criminal sanction. That's what malfeasance is in shorthand. There is also misfeasance in the public procurement supply chain, and that is the type of situation in which either negligently or due to innocent or incompetent reasons, money that should be expended in a particular way is not expended in that way. So when I talk in the submission of malfeasance, I'm talking about criminal activity, and when I talk about misfeasance, I'm talking about negligent or incompetent procurement in the supply chain of the state and the state-owned enterprises. And I think that it's probably, while we are talking about malfeasance and misfeasance, important to draw to the attention of the committee something that I only found out when I sat down a little bit early now this morning. There is a report today in the BLT newspaper, which I'm sure nobody reads, which is carried into legal brief this morning. And I'm just going to give you a quick rundown of what the report covers. It comes under the heading Strategy to Fight State Capture and Corruption. And it is a report of a speech that our new finance minister, Nhlanhla Nene, had at a union, Federation of Unions of South Africa conference yesterday. And what he said was that the government will announce its strategy to fight corruption and state capture within 100 days. Almost, this is the minister speaking, almost all South Africans and foreign investors have lost confidence in South Africa. This situation must be turned around urgently. Now, I know that we all live in silos. My silo is in Noordhoek, and yours is in Parliament. But I do hope that there is some cross-pollination between the deliberations of this committee and whatever the minister has in mind, because we should all be on the same page with something as serious as the fight against corrupt activity, especially insofar as state capture and indeed the procurement of goods and services for the state is concerned. So So I think that somewhere in those 100 days, there ought to be a liaison with what the minister has in mind, because that is obviously an executive-sourced initiative, whereas here we are in the legislature. Now, obviously, the minister is speaking only of malfeasance there, state capture, which is just a fancy form of corruption and corruption itself. When it comes to misfeasance, the second form of mischief that I have identified, what we really are seeking a workaround solution to is that too many people involved in procurement of goods and services for the state don't know how to do their jobs properly, do their jobs incompetently, do their jobs negligently, don't have their eye on the ball, and end up with, I think the last time the Auditor General reported, there was 46 billion rand that went waste in the procurement supply chain in South Africa. And that is clearly an amount that the country cannot afford. So moving to my second point, because time is tight, I want to place our discussion in its correct context. I think we need to bear in mind that South Africa is committed to the United Nations Strategic Development Goals, and I would draw the attention of the committee to SDG 16, which talks of strong institutions of government, and that is ideally what is required in order to render the future of the planet sustainable and the future of constitutional democracy as a similar fate. The second general point is that South Africa is bound by various international instruments in its work against corruption. And I would give you the United Nations Convention Against Corruption, which doesn't translate into Afrikaans very well when you use the acronym. I would give you the African Union Convention to the similar effect, and also the SADC Protocol Against Corruption. All of these require that there should be independent anti-corruption machinery of state. And I know that the Chair has heard me say this before in the Constitutional Review Committee, so I'm not going to take up a lot of time on the international aspects of the obligations of the state that need to find expression in any legislation that flows from these deliberations. And then the constitutional framework of South Africa is really one in which the separation of powers between the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary is well defined and is part of the constitutional dispensation itself. I don't need to remind the committee of the judgment of the Constitutional Court, in which the Chief Justice put in a very strong dissent in support of the notion of the separation of powers in relation to the failure of Parliament to put machinery in place for effecting the removal from office, or impeachment, as we like to say colloquially, of our President when the need for that could arise. The Chapter 9 institutions are there because they support and strengthen constitutional democracy. That is what Section 181 says. They are required to be independent, to operate without fear, favour or prejudice, and the committee will know that these institutions are accountable to Parliament, not to the executive, and that the other organs of state, other than the Chapter 9 institutions, are required to assist and protect them, to ensure their independence, impartiality, dignity, and their effectiveness. And clearly, turning the Auditor General into a debt collecting agent of the executive branch of government, it runs counter to the subsections of section 181 and counter to the doctrine of the separation of powers. So I'm pleased to hear in the introductory comments of the chair that there is no appetite for that in this committee, and it makes my task this morning somewhat easier. But I think if we go down to specifics, I'm now reaching the 21 questions which are followed by some loaded suggestions in the memo that we've got, the email that we've given the secretary of this committee. I think that what we really need to do is disabuse ourselves of workaround solutions and rather treat causes than symptoms when we are dealing with misfeasance and malfeasance in the procurement of goods and services for the state. We all know, in terms of section 217, fair, equitable, cost-effective, transparent, and what's the last one there? I'm not sure there. No, I've given you five, sorry. They're all there. Those criteria are the criteria for the procurement of goods and services for the state. And if any of them are not adhered to, then that procurement is invalid if the invalidity has come about through deliberate, intentional actions, then criminal consequences follow. And one of the criminal consequences that can follow is that under Section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act, it is possible for a criminal court to order compensation be paid by the person charged with corrupt activities or theft or fraud or extortion or whatever the charge may be. While we're on the Criminal Procedure Act, Section 269 capital A is the section that hasn't got an introductory line that was left out in the English version, but in the Afrikaans version, there is competent verdicts in respect of statutory offences of corrupt activities. And that section, in effect, says if you charge somebody under PREGA and you don't discharge your onus of proof, you can still secure a conviction for theft, for fraud, or extortion. So the criminal justice law is properly aligned to deal with people who are thieving, who are corrupt, who are guilty of malfeasance in procurement as uncovered by the Auditor General from time to time. And we do know from the lips of Justice Dennis Davis that 3,000 dockets are sitting at the NPA, this was more than a year ago, relating to criminal activity in the procurement chain, and the NPA has been slow to process them. I think this committee would do well to ask the NPA what has become of those 3,000 dockets, because clearly there's a great deal of money tied up in successful conviction of those who have been guilty of malfeasance in the public supply chain. I think that it is also something for the committee to consider that the workaround solution here is because the Hawks and the NPA have been dysfunctional. The Hawks are so dysfunctional that the executive branch of government has created an abomination called the Anti-Corruption Task Team. It has no legal status at all, and it is meant to deal with big cases of corruption. I'm pleased that the chair did not mention it in his introductory comments, because it doesn't actually belong there. It's not part of the design of the Constitution, and it is contrary to the rulings of the Constitutional Court in Glenister 2 and in Glenister 3. Glenister 2 was in 2011, Tennant III was in 2014, and those judgments make it very clear that an adequately independent and effective single body is what our constitution requires if we are going to get, as the Chief Justice put it, on top of this malady that we call corruption. So while the anti-corruption task team has never secured a conviction as a result of an opposed criminal trial, it is getting in the way of the efficient and effective countering of corruption and state capture. And it needs to be, the hawks really do need to be recapacitated or replaced, as we have suggested to the Constitutional Review Committee, by an integrity commission. And we've given this committee the references to the work that has been done in that regard. I think that I've now got 1 minute to go, according to my timing. But I'm prepared, because I do want to go and see what happens to the public protectors this morning, to shut up now and take the field question.
Thank you very much, sir. We would have given you an extra minute or two if you really wanted to, but so if you want to, you can just stop. Or maybe we should just do it so that I don't have to worry. We'll take the honourable member on the furthest to the left. I'm not sure who it is right now. Mr. Trombella, if there's anything you want to say,
sir, put it on the
table.
You can pass it for now.
Honourable Carter. And Honourable McLaughlin.
Thank you, sir. Advocate, can I just ask you, a misfeasance, would you regard a misfeasance as a delict?
Yes.
And therefore recoverable in delictual terms?
Yes, I think that what
one needs to do to distinguish the two is to look at how different a body the Hawks is to the public protector. The public protector is there to investigate, report on, and take appropriate remedial action in respect of maladministration of the affairs of state and the public administration. And this is what the Auditor General is uncovering every time he does an audit. He finds that. Now, addressing it through a properly capacitated public protector is what it's there for. But the cause of a lot of the misfeasance in which would give rise to delictual liability if you could prove negligence, is that there is across the board cadre deployment committees of the ANC in the public administration and in the state-owned enterprises. And this has been ruled unconstitutional and illegal in the Molokoti case. It is also contrary to section 195(1)(h) of the Constitution itself, which requires sound human resource management. So for so long as that continues, workaround solutions are not going to be the answer. What really needs to be addressed is the levels of competence of those who work in the public administration and in the state and enterprises.
Thank you very much. Advocate, in terms of the bill that we have before us, or the one that you looked at, and your comments, on my understanding. My understanding, therefore, is that this thing that you call the Integrity Commission is a constitutional amendment and therefore doesn't affect the bill before us. That's my first understanding. And then secondly, you are not violently opposed to the proposal that we were making in terms of the debt collection and the referral options that we have. If you have any comment to strengthen it, you may do so. Other than that, my understanding is, and I agree with you, that maybe the laws are there in terms of the criminal Procedures Act and those type of things. But that is for another committee, it's not for this committee in terms of what we're doing here. So in terms of this piece of paper that we have here, if we made changes after everything was said and done to those two areas that we spoke about, would it be livable for you? I think that's the question that we have to ask everybody else, over and above the integrity, because that belongs to another committee. Comments, sir?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I think that the constitutionally correct approach would be to say that the mission, the constitutional duty of the Auditor General does not include debt collecting. Whether the debt collecting is from those who have committed crimes and have somehow in the criminal justice administration not been ordered to compensate, because it's within the discretion of the court as to whether compensation is ordered or not. So the what is uncovered in the audits could be categorized as criminal activity or could be categorized as misfeasance, as I've called it for the sake of one word. The criminal law is there to be administered and to deal with criminality, state capture included. But the civil law is there to deal with those who have been guilty of unauthorized expenditure or wasteful expenditure. The type of activity which does not include a criminal intent, but is happening by mistake rather than by deliberate effort. As far as the misfeasance part of the referrals is concerned, it's my submission that the money that has been earmarked in this bill for the purpose of setting up the Auditor General as a debt collecting institution should in fact be allocated to the State Attorney. I think even if the State Attorney were to have an official who is the liaison with the Auditor General in each main center in South Africa, you would then be able to have an ongoing interaction between the State Attorney and the Auditor General, where each is sticking to his own knitting. The Auditor General is doing auditing, and the State Attorney is doing recovery work of public money that has been misspent without criminality being involved. So I think that doesn't require legislation as such. What it requires is Section 41 of the Constitution being applied to the relationship between the State Attorney and the Auditor General. See, the difficulty is that the Auditor General is a highly functional body, as this committee no doubt knows, because it reports to this committee, whereas the State Attorney is underfunded and under-resourced in terms of human capacity. So the average attorney in the State Attorney's office is sitting on 700 files at a time. That's too much work for one person. And the cure is to appoint more staff. Or, if we are wanting, because let's face it, corruption in procurement is not a victimless crime. The corruption in procurement is stealing money from the poor. And that needs to be dealt with professionally by those who have the qualifications to debt collect according to the ethical standards of their own profession. And that isn't the auditor's job at all. It's the lawyer's job. And the State Attorney, properly capacitated, or putting a liaison person into various provinces where the shoe is pinching to get reports and act on reports that arise out of what the Auditor General uncovers is what it's about. I think the Auditor General is like the canary in the coal mine. I made that submission. He is the first warning that there's something wrong here. And if the anti-corruption machinery of state and the debt-collecting machinery of state, in the Integrity Commission if we get our way, or in the Hawks if we don't, and in the State Attorney, is really what needs to be. You're not doing a workaround when you capacitate those properly. You are dealing with the causes rather than the symptoms. And if you deal with the causes, then you're out of the woods in getting to the core of the problem.
All right. I think we're going to have a lot of debate on the members on the subject. I hope you're not going to quote me on this, any of you. You know, I've been in this institution too long. And I know that the state attorney's office is just not up to scratch. It's just not up to scratch. And I said to members on Friday, you know, if we continue to do the same thing over and over again, why do we think we're going to get different results? Why do we think we're going to get different results? That was my comment to honorable members. Now, and that's why I'm saying we're going to have to think out of the box. I can give you numerous occasions, advocate, of where debt has prescribed.
On the test code.
Yes. Now, so when you come to me and you say to me, don't give it to the AG, and we might agree, but give it to somebody else who I know in my heart is not going to do it, I can't sleep easy at night. And to then turn around and say, but capacitate them, whilst on the other hand, we are saying the wage bill of the state is so high. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I can't argue for capacitation, which means more bodies, so that the workload goes down, and then the other side say, but this wage bill is bloated. So it's really challenging. So we have to find a way of dealing with it. But thank you very much, Edward. And that's what I'm saying. Okay, you're coming. Honorable members, we're going to have this discussion. I think the principle is we agree. It can't be the AG that must run around and collect money. The question is, who is the relevant? Not only the relevant, but who is the best capacitated and suitable person to do the kind of work. Otherwise, there's no consequences. And people will just say, well, it's fine, let the auditor refer it. 100 years down the line, I'll go with my pension. So that's the real discussion that we're going to have. And I'm hoping that the AG and even our backroom staff will help us to sharpen when we get to it eventually, because get to it we must. McLaughlin, over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. I don't need a long answer on this one, but just perhaps if you know offhand, is there anything to prevent the state instructing a private firm of attorneys to do a collection?
Short answer, nothing.
With that short answer, sir, thank you very much. You may go and observe what's happening to the public protector.
Can't wait.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. All right, Mr. Naidu, it is 2:15. We'll give you and your team and throw 5 pounds at the absolute latest, and we'll go through the same procedure. And it is according to 27. What is 27? Number 27. Okay. Thank you. Over to you, Mr. Naidu.
Thank you, Chair and honourable members. Acknowledge the presence of the Auditor General, Mr. McCracken, here this morning. Chair, I don't anticipate taking 15 minutes, let alone 20. I think you summarised the key issues for us, and we're trying to focus on that. But perhaps before doing so, I mean, I want to, and you know, one of the reasons that CASAC was interested in participating in this process is around the constitutional importance of this office and the role that it plays, not just in terms of looking at the detail of what's in this amendment bill, which we're obviously focused on at the moment, but I think when doing that we've got to understand and have, you know, due acknowledgement for the key role that this office plays in our democracy. African Hoffman referred to it as the canary in the mine. But if we are serious about accountability, then this office is the kernel of that. Without this office, there will be no accountability within our public administration in South Africa, and we've got to look at it in that context. I think it's for that reason that this office has been created as a Chapter 9 institution, and independence is guaranteed in the Constitution. In terms of its constitutional provisions, however, lacking in teeth. It is a reporting body that conducts an audit and reports to the relevant legislature, whether it be the National Assembly or provincial legislatures or to municipalities. And I think, you know, to draw a very simple difference between the Office of the Auditor General and that of the Public Protector is, in terms of its constitutional mandate, the fact that the Office of the Auditor General does not have the power to institute binding remedial action. And I think really that's what we're talking about here. How do we make this office more effective? I think we've seen over a number of years reports that emanate from the Office of the Auditor General that come to Parliament, come to SCOPA, get referred, and there are no real consequences of what happens. And so the mischief, as you said, is what is it that this piece of legislation is seeking to fix? What is the problem that we see there? As I said, we've seen huge amounts of reports of wasteful expenditure, unauthorized expenditure. Every year the reports of the Auditor General point to billions and billions of rand that are wasted in this way. That undermines the ability of the state to deliver on its constitutional mandate, which is to deliver on socio-economic rights for the people of South Africa. I think that, you know, we have also honed in on the two issues you've raised, Chair, and I'll touch on them, on both of them. In terms of reporting referrals and then the debt collecting aspect. The auditor at the moment has a restricted reporting role, reporting undesirable outcomes that it covers, and therefore relying on the intermediary, the middleman, middle person, to effect the change, to ensure effective remedies or accountability from the relevant department. That's obviously something that in practice has not worked well, and that's what the bill is seeking to achieve. In order to enhance the capacity of the Auditor General, we believe that there are two possible solutions that we could look at. Firstly, that the AG should have referral powers to authorities other than legislatures, and you've touched on the issue of referring to the Hawks, the NPA, and even the SIU, and we would support all of those. That we believe that we need to find mechanisms to give greater effectiveness to the findings that are made by the Auditor General, or findings that are made during the audit process. Obviously, in relation to any referral to the SIU, there will have to be a mechanism that's built in, which could be built in by the regulation, because that is something that is a presidential power to deal with the SIU. So it's a technical issue that can be dealt with, but we would certainly support that initiative that we refer to the appropriate body, whether it be the NPA, the SIU, or the Hawks. I don't think it would be appropriate for the AG to refer from the AG to the Public Protector. I think going from one Chapter 9 institution to another doesn't really assist us in this process, and would be a duplication of the effort and a diluting of the focus of each of those key bodies. We're saying that the AG should have the necessary powers to follow up any undesirable, unlawful, or improper conduct that it comes. If we contrast the powers of the Auditor General again with that of the Public Protector, in the Public Protector Act, it says in Section 6, Subsection 4C, Roman numeral 1, and I quote, if he or she is of the opinion that the facts disclosed the commission of an offence by any person, to bring the matter to the notice of the relevant authority charged with prosecution. And then in Roman numeral 2, to refer any matter which has a bearing on an investigation to the appropriate public body or authority affected by it, or to make an appropriate recommendation. So we have an example of this with another Chapter 9 institution. So I don't think we'd be really breaking new ground in going here in respect of the powers of the Auditor General. On the issue of the debt recovery aspect, and I think again the mischief here, and I want to draw an analogy, for example, with cases of procurement irregularities, corruption, malfeasance in terms of public procurement. And we see this in the inability of organs of state to effectively institute disciplinary processes against people who've been implicated therein. So why do we think it's going to be any different if we charge those same organs of state to hold people to account by having to repay money? I don't think that's going to work. I think it's ineffective because the level of political support and cover-up that happens is something we've seen. We've seen a culture of impunity in South Africa, and I think this is something that this piece of legislation needs to overcome. So the question is, how does that happen? And I, you know, we're not wedded to any particular idea. With your permission, Mr. Chair, on the basis of the discussion this morning, we would like to submit a short additional memo on this matter because, for example, we understand that Treasury has the power to recover losses for unauthorized, irregular, fruitless and wasteful expenditure in terms of the regulations to the BFMA, Regulation 9 and Regulation 12 in particular. So that would be one aspect of dealing with this, is to say that let Treasury do that. One thing we must avoid, and the point I want to stress, is I don't think we can give those departments where the maladministration or corruption has occurred the power to rectify. That is something that has not happened, that has failed, and we need to correct that. So we've got to find a solution other than that. So whether it's Treasury, whether it's through, I don't believe that the State Attorney's Office is the appropriate one to do it because for the reasons you've outlined, Chair. But I think we do need to look at that. So whilst it's not ideal that the Office of the Auditor General becomes a debt recovery agency, in the absence of another effective mechanism, I think it's something that we need to consider, and we therefore need to consider how it can best execute that function without detracting from its core mandate, which is to provide audit services to the state. So that's what. We had a couple of additional issues that were happening. One, for example, being that we thought that the time limit for repayment of 180 days was too long, that it should be set at 90 days as one of the issues. And that we should also consider the position of the debtor in a little bit more detail. Because as it stands, the only recourse for an aggrieved debtor is a process of judicial review. So we're saying, is there not a mechanism that we can put in place through some sort of internal panel that reviews such a decision as a precursor to going to court? But that's really about due process and being fair to all parties in the matter. A couple of final thoughts around the issue of the referral powers. I think I've actually touched on these. Chair, I think that, you know, for the moment, I think I want to leave it there because I think those are the key issues you've identified, which we had identified. So perhaps any questions or further discussion.
Thanks, Mr. Naidoo. Again, Mr. Ntombela, any input from your side, sir?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much, Chairperson. On the part of the recovery of debt, the presentation says it supports the retention of the judicial review option. And there is a proposal that an additional mechanism of internal appeal or review to an independent panel be created by the Auditor General. Chairperson, at issue with me here is that the essence of the grief by the debtor is actually the creation or the effort of the AG to address an administrative malady. Now, how do you, I'm trying to get clarity here, how do you propose a retention thereof? Well, there seems to be a contradiction, if I understand very well what Clause 16 says there. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Carter, you take two and you'll respond and we'll give them. Carter? No, you covered. Thank you, Honorable Clapham.
I'm fine for nothing.
Thank you, Honorable Sheikh.
Sorry, that was
fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. I just want to emphasize the part raised by Honorable Ntombela about an additional review mechanism. And we'll put it to you as we discuss so that all of you are able to challenge that. Our argument on Friday, and I think it was raised and led by Honorable Ntombela, was, you know, because we want consequences, the court is the last arbiter. Maybe we should just go there, because you can't argue for 180 days is too long, and then add an extra mechanism. That was the argument that we raised. We said, and you can tell us why you think that maybe it's too harsh to go directly to the court. I know somebody else raised the issue around the costs and so on, if you have to go to court, from a debtor's point of view, that was raised. But at the end of the day, I thought we thought, look, you can't talk about costs if you're stealing billions of rands from the state. I mean, that was the sentiment, but you can talk to them. The other issue, National Treasury is a new one. I think we can look at that one, but we can talk to it. The other one that we raised, and you also raised around the referral, our argument initially, and we've now subsequently, I think, come to agreement. Our argument initially is that the Auditor General gives us things to the hawks or whoever. And those people just decide we're not going to do anything about it. We're just not going to do anything about it. Is there a memorandum of understanding that should be there? Do we then take it to the chairs of committees and say to them, this thing has been referred? The question that these ladies and gentlemen on this side are asking is, what must be done so that there are consequences? That's really what we're asking. You refer it to a body that deliberately sits on it. What have we done? Those are the problems that we're trying to address. And if you're saying the AG must have teeth, what do you mean he must have teeth if you're saying he's giving teeth but then refer it to somebody else? We're playing devil's advocate. Why give him teeth and refer it to somebody else? I don't know. We don't have the answers, but when we're done with this bill, and I think South Africans are clamoring for the AG to have teeth. They really are. But if we go with the bill that says, all we've done now is saying to AG, do the work, Mr. AG, and give it to SAPS, who people have no trust in. I'm not saying they don't, but I'm just using it as an example, or give it to an agency that people don't have trust in. Are we really giving the AG teeth? You guys must be able to answer those questions for us. That's the intention. So if you could deal with those, if there's any that you want to deal with, then it's fine. Over to you, sir.
Chair, I'm going to ask my colleague, Michael, to just kick off and I'll add to it.
That's fine.
Thank you, Chair. I just would like to touch on the issue of the internal appeal. It's not uncommon in administrative law to have these internal review procedures. In PAJA, it's mentioned, it's contemplated. We see it a lot in various areas of administrative law. Housing comes to mind, and there's quite a few of them. The point is that judicial review is expensive, and it can often take a lot longer than 90 and 80 days. So having an internal appeal mechanism might slow down the 90-day process, but it could actually save time in the end, because judicial review can take, as we know, a lot longer than that. And that would need to be considered if we have a 90-day or 180-day process. If somebody launches an internal review procedure, whether that spends that time. We know a lot of these institutions are complaining about lack of funds. Judicial review is expensive. It's time consuming, as I said. And it should be retained as an option, but it's not uncommon to have a simple opportunity for the debtor to make written representations or submissions before this expensive and time consuming court process is embarked upon. not uncommon, and I think a simple opportunity to make representation will be sufficient.
Yeah, just to add on the issue of the example you used, Honourable Chair, regarding the Hawks and the potential MOU. I mean, I don't think that an MOU between the Hawks and the AG is going to have any provide any more teeth than the legal and constitutional mandate that the Hawks have anyway. And the fact that Hawks like the Hawks are failing to live up to their legal and constitutional mandate is what the problem is. And that's something that can't be fixed by this bill. But the fact of referring it, giving the AG the authority to refer such a matter to whether it's to the Hawks app or, as we've discussed, to the SRU, is the key issue here. And you know, other oversight bodies need to take responsibility of ensuring that what lands at the door of the Hawks doesn't in fact get investigated and pursued. So I don't think we must look at fixing everything here. Through this piece of legislation, but saying this is a step in the process, and the process is the wrong is discovered here. It is either fixed through the process of recovery that we've discussed, if it's against the debtor, or if it's a more serious matter that needs further investigation, more detailed investigation, more specific investigation, so to be or whosoever. But that then is a part of the process. So that's really about I think what we understand by saying giving teeth to the AG to say how do we take this forward beyond just what they're currently limited to into referring it to Parliament or to the provincial legislature, when we've seen that things can often get bogged down. So this is really about taking it a step further than where the current legal framework allows it to go.
Any second banks or members on the side?
Thank you, Chair.
You want to on the road here?
Thank you, Chair. I think CASAC knows a lot better. You must assist us. I'm taking the feet of the debtor now. I mean the feet of the debtor, who has a grievance against the Auditor General for having investigated whatever that he investigated and got the outcome that he got. This person, as a way of addressing his grief, we're creating a panel. But the same panel that has to look into the matter is created by the Auditor General. Can't we find a better way of dealing with it? Because it would seem very suspicious to the debtor, but it is the same person who found these mistakes or the malfeasance, so to speak. How does he create a panel for me? How should it work? I've got a problem with that. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Carter?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, mine's also very much on the same basis. How do you have an independent, almost independent committee to look at it? Because you can't be, you can't be the player and, and then another question just on how to more sort of to assist us. We're looking at a situation where we say let's refer it to, let's look at recovery or refer it to the Hawks. But the question is, what do we look at time frame? You know, just having a recovery is not enough. That person or persons involved should never be employed in the state again. So I think you really need to go steps further. If you really want to give the AG teeth, then we've got to give them teeth that can deal with it properly so that they don't resurface somewhere else. What advice would you have?
Honourable McLaughlin, if any?
Thank you, Chair. Just a short one. Do you see any difference between the person who is going to be disputing a finding and that person who doesn't dispute the finding? Are you saying that in that instance somebody can make some kind of deal once he's found out and say, right, I'll repay given the terms, etc., etc.? Is it only related to those instances, or are you seeing a whole different scenario that even in a disputed matter there should be some kind of interim process before he gets to court for the laws or whatever?
Honourable thing. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. That is the problem, that
in an office or a panel within the AG is making a determination on something they have a substantial interest. Again, it's not uncommon, and I would say it's better than nothing. I'd like to use an example in the bill, which is the Remuneration Committee, which has a panel of 5 members, and the requirement is that at least 3 cannot be in the employ of the Auditor General's office. So a panel with that sort of composition, but it's independent but also has expertise within the office, might be appropriate. Again, to use an example of housing and legislation, I don't know the exact provisions and the exact act of the head, but that procedure, there is an internal review panel within the body responsible for making the decision, and it's not ideal, I agree with you. But it is simply, I think, how we envisage it is an aggrieved debtor, so would lodge an objection, and they would have, say, 14 days to write a written submission, which can be evaluated by a panel that is compromised similarly to the Remuneration Committee. If they reject it, or if they say, look, we're going to go ahead, he has this this last resort of a court to make a final determination. Simply an internal review procedure to net out mistakes. To hopefully save a little bit of time.
On the issue of the independence of this panel, I mean, it's, you know, as my colleague has said, it's not uncommon. You know, there is a company law and audit committee similarly constituted with a majority of non-executive directors and so on. So it can be structured in a way to overcome those matters. I'll also take up the issue that Honourable Carter raised about, you know, weeding out the bad apples, if I may paraphrase you in that way. And I think that, again, this is something we've got to look at this as a process. It's not a power that we can give to the Auditor General to do that. I mean, I think the Auditor General needs to be given the authority to do what falls under their core mandate. Then the Department of Public Service and Administration needs to take over. They're supposed to, as I used the example earlier, disciplinary action, which they're failing to deal with at the moment. But that's something that belongs there. They need to make sure that these public servants who are found guilty of such transgression do not suddenly move from one local municipality to the one next door, and so on. And so let's place that responsibility. I agree with you that that should be the outcome, but let's place that responsibility where it belongs properly.
Yeah.
All right. As I say when I'm facing the stuff I'm not facing, is that this is your last opportunity to influence that. So if you don't do a good job, don't blame us afterwards. And I'm not suggesting for any minute that you're not doing a good job. I just want you to make life easier for us when we come back. So that members, we don't have to have a big fight about it, because we must fight. I'm sure we're going to fight as we go on. But if you want to try and influence a bit more, it's fine. It's clear that we're going to have to look at this thing about the internal review. But as I think you said early on, you've got between now and by the time the bill goes to always give us a one line, one paragraph to assist us as we go on. It's not like this is the last bite of the cherry. Over to you, sir.
Yeah, just on that point, Chair, we would appreciate the opportunity to give you a short submission on this issue of the independent panel, as well as the issue which we raised just now in terms of a potential role that could be played by Treasury in that debt recovery process.
Happiness? Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Niger, and your team. Thank you so much. And as we say, this to Africa as well. This is not the end of the road. You are more than welcome to submit to Cindy as you think about this. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Yeah, no, that's fine. Thank you very much. We also have a leave round that's fine.
If we reject it, if
can we carry on with the next round, or do you want the 5 minutes?
Five minutes.
Which means I know there was never a problem.
What is the matter? There is no government. There is no government. There is no collapse.
At least the mother could have been shown in a lot to go.
No, not outright, no. I'm the other one. There's a 51% in it.
Yeah.
51% is fine. So that, okay, what pies? You can get it to buy 3-4 people from the place.
Right. being a cooperative body set up by the presidency that brings together various entities, both at provincial and national and even local levels, in order to find out really what's going on, how are we working together to address these irregularities. And we're not sure, I mean, we've seen that the work of the ACTT hasn't been great. And so we're not then sure how this referral into a body like the ACTT or into the Hawks would be effective. And one of the ways that you could do this is through extensive consultation with this institution, the ACTT, and to agree on certain guidelines for referral. I'm not sure then whether that would be part of regulations to this act, because there has to be processes in place that speak to how will the referral work, are there time frames, whose responsibility is it, if you're dealing with the MFMA, if you're dealing with the PFMA, if it's issues around that are picked up in relation to possible money laundering, for example, that the audit speaks to losses, but losses incurred through money laundering and foreign bribery. You know, various institutions need to work together, and I know that Advocate Hoffman, you know, spoke to there being one single institution, but at the end of the day, there's a variety of institutions that do need to work together, whether to investigate or to really address meaningfully what has been raised through audits. And I think that part of the solution lies in either regulations or policy directives that could be done through PRECA, the PFMA, or this act, and to ensure that there is meaningful consultation in order to ensure enforcement. Now, if the issue is that, look, these bodies, which are not regulated in the ACTT, which includes the Hawks, that there is an issue around their functioning, and we're saying that whether you're looking at the State Attorney's Office, which I'll come to, or the ACTT, they're just institutions that are not functioning. Do we then accept that they're not functioning, and that the role of Parliament in overseeing the functioning, the effective functioning of these institutions, is lost? And that's really the question for us to answer. This issue about referrals to a body has an impact, and then speaking back to the teeth of the Auditor General's Office, it's not just an issue for the AG, it's an issue for all institutions, it's an issue for the general public at large, the non-functioning of these institutions. So here you're dealing with the non-functioning of the criminal justice system. And what do we do about that? And what role does the Auditor General, which sits on SCOPA, or does this committee have in trying to address that core issue? Because it's pervasive, right? And I'm really not sure what the complete answer to that is, because I think that saying that you need to give the Auditor General keys because other bodies are not functioning is an acceptance that the other bodies are not functioning, and so there's nothing that can be done. Because when the parliamentary committees that are charged with them sit and look at the work that they're doing, they're not in a position to ask them questions, to impose sanctions, and to make sure that they do function. And do we find ourselves in a different kind of space that enables them to function? I'm really not sure. On the issue of the role that civil society can play, I mean, we've seen civil society being very active in supporting initiatives, in being able to raise questions where questions need to be raised, and would there be a place for civil society in this referral process? You know, we've long been following the audit outcomes on SACSA, for example, and we've even taken a matter to the High Court where an amount of 317 million rand was raised in the annual report of SACSA 2014-2015, and that there was just never any follow-up, right? The minister would go to the relevant committee, they would have a discussion, there would never be an agreement of what would be done about that amount or other irregular conduct, and it would just kind of roll into the years. And so we took SACSA to court to say, this has been a result of an irregular procurement process, where the CEO paid an amount to a supplier without following procurement processes. And civil society can play a role there. And if we know what is being referred to the relevant authorities, if we know that these are the reasons for the referral, we could play a part in some sort of oversight. But again, does that form part of regulation? Does that form part of a cooperation agreement? Again, I'm not sure. But you're really here looking for sanctions. You're looking for enforceability. And what are the mechanisms that currently exist? I think that there are mechanisms that currently exist. How do we get them to work? What role does civil society play? And I think that the AG when notes are made on audits, that it's not just on expenditure, regular expenditure. There are notes in annual reports that speak to possible disciplinary action. For example, with SASA, there were individuals that needed to be investigated. And there were amounts that needed to be investigated. And we understand that the executive authority had commissioned a report on the individual, but that had never come to light. That on some of the irregular expenditure, it went to the Office of the Accountant General. Now, we wrote to the Office of the Accountant General and could get no feedback on where the status of that investigation was. So, you know, pockets of the report are farmed out to various departments, and there isn't any transparency. So, for us, transparency really is here key if you're trying to make sure that there is some sort of enforcement. On the recovery of losses, we also believe that there's potentially a role for the State Attorney's Office to play in respect of recovering debts that are due to the state. As a result of wasteful expenditure. And the questions were then raised around the role of the State Attorney's Office. Is it equipped to do so? And I think we should also be asking why aren't we looking at, and it may not be the job of this committee, but suddenly there needs to be a complete review of how the State Attorney's Office functions, because that's the office that's been set up to recover losses for the state. And it can't be that in order to address the inadequacies in one department, that you then give powers, legislative powers, to another department to do the exact same work. And that's our concern about duplication. And just about the objectives for this section, we understand the objectives for this recovery of losses. Firstly, it's in their personal capacity, accounting authorities in their personal capacity. That would be liable, whether they are boards or individuals. We raised this issue around the legal costs. The state is incurring legal costs on behalf of the accounting authority and on behalf of the AG. Judicial reviews can run into years and years, and how do we address that? Now, here, if we think of what is it that we're trying to achieve, accountability and deterrence. So we are saying we want to hold you, accounting authority, personally liable so that this deters future conduct for accounting authorities. Now, there's existing mechanisms in the PFMA. So if you read section 50 of the PFMA that speaks to fiduciary duties, you've also got duties for public officials, fiduciary in nature, and you read them with section 83 and 86 of the PFMA that speaks to financial misconduct firstly, and then the criminal, the criminality. So the offences is that it's a crime to breach your fiduciary duties in terms of the PFMA. Now, if in an ideal world where the PFMA was enforced and you had either the department concerned or a concerned stakeholder filing charges against the accounting authority, the official for breaches of those duties, I think you would see deterrence at a major level. That would really deter this kind of conduct, because you're looking at quite heavy fines and you're looking at, I think, up to 5 years jail time. But at the moment, you're not seeing those kinds of legislative offences being investigated. You're not seeing charges being brought. Where we have brought charges against, and I use a different example in terms of FICA, for legislative offences, it doesn't seem that the Hawks are capacitated to investigate those kinds of offences. So we brought a charge in terms of FICA against Commissioner SARS. We know they investigated the CRICA offense. They didn't investigate the FICA offense. Now there's a concern here about, here you have the PSMA designed to achieve exactly what you're wanting to achieve through these amendments, but is not being enforced. Do we accept that non-enforcement, or do we look at alternative ways of enabling, or not even enabling, of considering how National Treasury, which is responsible ultimately for this in collaboration with the Auditor General's office, to enforce those sections. So that's kind of our point there around the PSMA, and I think Mr. Naidoo made comments around the recovery of losses. I'm speaking here more about deterrence, which is what is ultimately aimed to be achieved for the sector. Then we're wanting to look at the role of the private sector. So when audits are conducted, it points to losses that are incurred through irregular procurement processes, for example. And here you could have the accounting authority, the supply chain management officer responsible for incurring those losses, but there could also be a role for private sector companies who bid irregularities, for example. Or let's say if you look at what happened with procurement in this realm of state capture, you've seen increasingly foreign entities where the companies or individuals coming to bear on procurement processes. Now, I'm not sure that these amendments are sufficiently looking at the role of those private and foreign entities, because I think that they are having a major role to play in procurement irregularities. If I just turn to what has been said in the most recent OECD report, this is a June 2016 OECD report on South Africa's compliance on the Convention on Foreign Bribery. Recommendations 9A to E deal with accounting and auditing, corporate compliance, internal controls, and ethics. And here, the OECD working group recommended that South Africa ensure false accounting cases are vigorously investigated and effectively prosecuted, that sanctions are imposed for false accounting practices. They also indicated that we need to take steps to raise awareness specifically on foreign bribery offences among auditors, including within the Auditor General, and ensure that the profession benefits from regular training, including specific methods for detecting foreign bribery, in order to facilitate a more active role in detecting foreign bribery, take steps to encourage the reporting of foreign bribery within the auditing profession and the Auditor General, and take meaningful steps to ensure that auditors who report reasonably and in good faith suspicious transactions of foreign bribery are protected from legal and other retaliatory action. Now, I know, the last one being raising awareness among SOEs of the requirement to establish social and ethics committees to strengthen internal controls, ethics, and compliance measures. Now, I know that these amendments may not be designed at the moment to address those kinds of issues, but I do think it's an opportunity to consider if you're looking at state entities and their compliance and deterrence around those issues, whether you should also be looking at foreign entities and the issue of foreign bribery, which has become such a major feature in procurement irregularities, especially given the report of the OECD, which is their third report on how we've not implemented recommendations successfully. The amendments to CRECA, which are with the department, which we've recently commented on, do deal with some of these issues. But again, it's going to take a multi-departmental stakeholder approach in order to address some of these issues. Because audits are the best way to detect issues around this. Whether it's money laundering or foreign bribery, it starts with the audit, and then where do we go to from there? And who has oversight? And who has the powers to make sure that what has been recommended is actually implemented? That's the key question. And I think lastly, sorry, and I know that I'm into time, there's an issue around institutions, departments referring audit outcomes to private law firms and forensic investigators for them to conduct internal investigations. We find this to be highly problematic. We've seen it in several departments they refer this to a law firm. The law firm conducts an investigation. Who knows where the report is? Because we're not given access to the report. We don't have access to findings. And I think if you look at what Hogan Lovells has done in relation to SARS, they then claim legal privilege in Parliament when they're required to report on investigation that Parliament requested. I mean, it's just bizarre. And then civil society never has a chance to actually check. I mean, again, I refer to SARS, and I don't mean to pick out a department, but it's just work that we have been doing. We had a person suspended on the back of a FICA report. SARS undertook to investigate that person and appointed Hogan Lovells to do so. Hogan Lovells conducted an investigation, never released a report. PwC conducted an investigation, never released the report. The person was reinstated. We don't know whether the reasons for him being reinstated were ever actually investigated, because he was reinstated for reasons that didn't pertain to his suspension. In any event, I'm trying to make a kind of an example of how these private investigations are really affecting how these irregular, whether it's regular expenditure, financial misconduct, or pure misconduct, how it's being addressed. And something has to be done about that, because it's also a time delay tactic in our view. I think that those are our submissions, we'll take questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Govindswamy. Let us then open up for questions and comments from anybody. Mr. Ntombela, any from your side?
Thank you, Chair. My question would be, what would you regard to the provisioning of effective enforcement of sanctions by the government non-existent at the moment? To an extent that, if where it's necessary, the PMFA or the MFFA should be tampered with in order to effect the sanctions where necessary. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Patrick?
No, not Patrick.
Thank you. Honourable McLaughlin?
I'm fine, Patrick.
Honourable Singh?
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, everybody. I can sense where corruption watch in Ms. Govindswamy is coming from, because there seems to be some scepticism on whether or not what we intend to do in this bill will be taken to its logical conclusion. And I think you're quite correct in referring to the PFMA, which is a 1999 document, the MFMA, and the consequences. But I think what we've seen at this level of this committee, sitting in the Committee of the Auditor General, and in consultation with our colleagues in SCOPA, that this act here is just a piece of paper. And that nobody so far has been prosecuted, no Director General has been head of department, accounting has been charged on this yet. And there are lots of transgressions. So do you see it as inherently wrong that this committee, with the Office of the Auditor General, is attempting to bring in these amendments to at least give the Office of the Auditor General, which has all the facts at its disposal in terms of financial irregularities, do you see it inherently wrong that we are proceeding with this, and then don't you think it should be given a chance? Because we can't allow the Auditor General's office to be the policeman, the prison warder, and all sorts of things. But I think it has specific responsibilities, it has facts and figures before it, and on the basis of those facts and figures, then they issue the certificates of debt. And the second point you make about the role of your stakeholders like yourself, I mean, you talk about referring the undesirable audit outcome, the progress of investigations. I think the report of an auditor general is a public document. It's put on the website in media of every department. Obviously, the management letters that are exchanged between the Office of the Auditor General and the accounting authority are internal memoranda to help the audit outcomes. So I think to that extent, there will be, the public will be informed if a particular head of department or accounting authority has been issued a certificate of debt, and surely they should be informed of progress in that regard. I don't think we want to hide that. And this legislation is not intended to do that. So So if you can just tell us what other role you think you can play, because you say civil society needs to play a role to be informed. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me just add my 2 cents to that. And again, you'll have an opportunity to respond. I thought I heard you, not lamenting, but I thought I heard you, heard a concern from your part that it's well and good for the AG to go to a department or an entity and do an investigation and report it, pick up the wrongdoing from the state employee. But what about the corruptor, or the one that I thought I heard you say something like that? And therefore, you thought there was a gap there. Maybe we should remind you that the AG works on a constitutional matter. And his brief is very clear. These are the entities that you that you interact with, and only those. And therefore, if your proposition that it's not going far enough holds, then it means there must be a constitutional change to that. That's the first thing. The second one is, you know, we had this fight on Friday amongst ourselves, and I thought that I successfully addressed it at the time, but you come in and reopen it, and there's no problem. I mean, we don't have to agree or disagree with each other. You know, this whole question about what is the mischief that you're trying to address, and is there mischief that you're trying to address, was a big fight that we had amongst each other. And if I look at your last two questions, have the amendments properly considered the role of the AG? Does it take all those things? And it's a valid concern that you have, not a concern. These are valid questions that you're raising. I am a proponent that the AG needs to have teeth, and that has been public all over the show. I'm getting a sense from what you're saying in your concluding remarks that, in fact, what we're trying to do is not necessary, or it is superfluous, or it can be addressed if you look at other pieces of legislation. Is that a fair understanding from my side? Because if it is, then you and I are going to have a big fight about it. But I don't have to win all the fights, but convince me otherwise. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair, Honourable Members. I think this may address a number of the questions. We're not, out of principle, opposed to the amendments. We're just not sure that the amendments are going to achieve what it's set out to achieve. So if we look at the referral and the potentially, I would say, oversight of the AG in respect of that referral, if you have an existing criminal justice system that isn't functioning as well as it should be, we're not sure that then the amendments will be effective. So it's to say that, in as much as, you know, we could welcome these amendments and say, yes, it does give the Auditor General teeth, does it in fact do so, will it achieve what we're hoping it will achieve, and so there should be other engagement by this committee within Parliament to try and look at the functioning of those institutions in order to make sure that it does what it sets out to do, whether that's through regulations to this Act or engagement to the relevant committees. That's really what our concern is. And even with the civil recovery issue, we could say that this is aimed at penalizing accounting authorities, at deterrence, etc. But if you do a cost analysis in respect of the legal costs that will be incurred, I would imagine that any accounting authority would really, you know, even if there weren't merits, try and oppose applications that are brought. If you have a accounting authority that has, through the consistent engagement of 3 years, through the AG's office, engaging with them on these issues, right? If you have an accounting authority that has not responded or has not provided reasons or is being dilatory for whatever reason, I'm not sure then, because you issue the certificate of death, there's going to be a change in behavior. It may just result in more legal opposition to the certificate of death being issued in the first place? And does that take us where we want to? So for me, it's more about, yes, we could implement these, but there are other avenues that currently exist that could also address these issues. And we need to take those into account. On the direct questions, on the first question on whether I see sanctions as the existing sanctions as non-existent, in terms of the PFNMA, I think they've been largely non-existent, either because charges haven't been brought against accounting authorities, or where charges have been brought, there hasn't been investigations. And there certainly isn't a willingness to cooperate with complainants. So we as Corruption Watch would be a complainant, bring a charge. And we have also, you know, I mean the Hawks, the investigating authorities and the NPA would have a duty to engage with us as a complainant. As a general civil society organization, I understand. But as a complainant interested in a particular issue, bringing a matter in the public interest, if in those cases they're not engaging with us. If we brought a charge, if I as an individual brought a charge of murder against somebody, wouldn't I have the right to be informed about the progress of an investigation? And that for us is a major concern, because now it's been almost 2 years, for example, that we've brought charges in the SARS matter. And so it's huge issues of transparency, and I don't think they're limited to the PFMA. I think that they are more pervasive. But we do also engage with Hawks officials on smaller matters where they do incredible work. And they do, in fact, intervene. And so where's the disconnect between officials that deal with smaller matters and then these high-profile matters that they can't seem to get anywhere with? So that's our concern. On the question about whether we see the amendments as inherently wrong, I think I've partly answered that. We don't see the amendments as inherently wrong. We do have an issue about whether they will achieve what they hope to achieve, or whether the AG's office is just going to become mired in legal battles. We completely agree that the Auditor General needs to have teeth. Please don't misunderstand. There needs to be enforcement of these findings. I'm really not sure that this is necessarily the best way to go, where you're covering 900 institutions, for example, and you're dealing with so many departments, and you may not have anybody applying for the position of accounting authority if you're issuing these personal certificates of death. It may become like an at-risk job to take. And so, because it may not be their fault, you know, it may be the fault of the officials, it may be historical issues, I don't know, but those are our concerns. We support the work of the AG, we support the work that this committee is doing, and I think in the role of civil society, where I referred to the referrals, we could have access to the referrals that are made by the AG to the Hawks. But it was more focused on, will the Hawks have an obligation to feed back information to the AG's office? What's the turnaround time there? Will we have access to that information on the progress of investigations? Because they often claim that it will compromise investigations, but you're dealing here with the expenditure of state resources. And surely the public is supposed to have access to this. And I think the same goes for the issue around private entities. We're not saying have a constitutional amendment. But as we understand it, the audit outcomes are in respect of public resources. And whether through SCOPA or through the AG's office, there are private entities being implicated. And we're not certain that there's enough focus on their role and it may not be the mandate, the appropriate mandate of the Auditor General, but they certainly pick it up. And so who's following that through if you have a recalcitrant department or executive authority or accounting authority? So it's more of who's having oversight in respect of that entire process and bringing it back to make sure that something has happened. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm saying it to you, ma'am, and to everybody else. We've never in a million years ever said that this is the panacea to all the problems. never. And so there are going to be other problems that this is not going to address, maybe not today or maybe not ever. And the question that we have to answer before we take it to the House is really, is this necessary? And when you come before us, you know, we're going to convince us whether it's necessary or not. I told you what my personal views are. The committee will deliberate on those things. But we've never thought it's the panacea to problems. We also have been very conscious of the fact that we don't want to be a super committee, where we can go and tell communications or defense or anybody else, you will do this and you will do that. I take your point, ma'am, that so the hawks are not working. It's not our problem, it's the police's problem. We really couldn't go to the police portfolio committee and say, you know, pull up your socks because the hawks are not working. But we've been very conscious not to do that on our side. But we take your point that it's a parliamentary responsibility. We're just part of that responsibility. So we'll take those things into consideration, honourable members, and ultimately answer the question. Because if we think that the AG or what we were doing is a pipe dream or we were wasting time, I think we're humble enough to say we made a mistake. We're not going to do it. It's our fault, by the way. We will withdraw it if you guys tell us we must withdraw it. That doesn't make sense. But I've told you what our views are to now. So thank you very much, honourable members. I don't know if you want to have one more bite. My fear is I don't want to dialogue. Remember, it was about input for us to have it. But if you really want to ask a question, anybody else here, please do that. We're running out of time with Ms. Government Party, but Ms. Ntobela, any questions
okay.
on your side?
Okay, sir. Thank you.
Honourable Carter?
No, I just had a comment.
No, make a comment, ma'am. Make your comment.
Thanks, Jay. You know, I think the first thing, when we talk about accounting officers, if it's a deterrent for someone to become an accounting officer, if they cannot do the job, then it's the right thing. Then I think we've actually achieved something. You know, you take other, let's take the IEC, for example. You cannot become an accounting officer of the IEC if you basically don't put security down that if there's any loss that you will personally be held responsible for it. And if we can achieve that, it's wonderful.
Honourable McLaughlin.
Thank you, Chair. Another one, you can give me a one-word answer on this one. In my opinion, this government has tended to take the approach that if we pass more laws, we create more legal compliance. In other words, citizens become more law-abiding. Are you perceiving this to be in that same mode?
Honourable Singh. Thank you, ma'am.
Partially, because, you know, for us this bill really raises the question of are we trying to find a legislative solution to what is an enforcement problem? And that is, it's a real difficulty for us because it's about executive...
Right, there we have it. I see your colleagues shaking their heads here. Yeah. They're obviously in agreement with you. I'll make time to convince you otherwise. Yeah. We'll find time to convince you otherwise. But like I said, this is not about you convincing us or we convincing you. It's about empowering us. But I'm saying it again to members. The question that you're going to answer before we take it to the House, was it, is it necessary to do what we are doing to address the mischief? Is everybody saying this mischief? Is this the most appropriate way to address the mischief? That's going to be the question we have to answer ultimately. Yeah. So if it means we must take you for a team of governance, I mean, we will do that. Depending on the boss next to me, time permitting, we might do that. But thank you so much, ma'am. You please to stay with us. We're not going to be here much longer. So are you going to stay with us or are you free to leave? It's really up to you. According to our program, our colleagues from Rand Watch are they here? Okay, let me just indicate that if you had come earlier, and it's not your fault that you weren't here, we would have pleaded with you to bear with us that we can't do overhead projections because there's some technical challenges from our side. So we will go through, we've got the printed version of your slide. You can talk with their members if you look at the printed version. Secondly, you would be aware that we've given you 15 minutes, after which we will then challenge you on what you put on the table and take it from there. It is 11 o'clock, and 12 o'clock 11 we ask you to round up and then you will take questions from the overseas.
Thank you, Honorable Vincent. My name is Ntombifikile Fania Mokwane Sithole. I'm the Group Governance Executive at Rainwater, a state-owned entity under the leadership of 100% shareholder, the Minister of Water and Sanitation. I'm joined by Ms. Alaris Bosch, the Group Legal Services Manager at Rainwater, and one of our legal practitioners, Ms. Lebu Mutfedin. We would like to thank the committee for the opportunity afforded to us. I'm happy to see the AG in the meeting. He addressed the public sector forum for internal auditors last week, and this is one key strategic initiative that he addressed us on. And as a call for us to also participate in building the nation, it is deemed necessary for Rainwater to then provide commentary as we shape the country for a better future for all. I'd like to hand over to Ms. Lebo Mutfedin to do the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, everyone. I'll try and be brief. I cannot go into the full detail of the presentation. Chairperson has indicated that we are a bit pressed for time. As we submitted our detailed comments to Ms. Bailey, Rainwater is not inherently opposed to the amendments. However, we had a few questions that we noted. It's more a question of clarity and the way in which the amendments are written that we had concerned with. We do appreciate the initiative because we believe that it's intended to ensure that there are greater levels of compliance by all SOEs, because in the South African context, we appreciate that SOEs are intended to be the lead agents for economic development as we aspire to be, as we are a developmental state. In our view, we saw the amendment as an attempt to enhance accountability and responsibility of persons entrusted with financial management and with financial management that underscores good governance. This will also go a long way in assisting SOEs in achieving their full regulatory mandate. So we have four main areas of, I won't say concern, but where we saw that there might be ambiguity or the provisions are not clearly drafted. The first one was in reference to the referral for criminal investigation. Our view with regard to this one is the wording of the amendment. The amendment is worded in such a way that it reads as permissive and not mandatory. It is as though the AG will have the discretion to decide whether to refer the matter for further investigation or not. And it doesn't say what will happen in the instance that the AG does not refer the matter for investigation. What is the remedial provision in that instance? Furthermore to that is that we could not make sense in what instances would the AG refer this matter, in what instances would they not. And if you make the provision permissive, does it not leave it open for abuse and selective application?
what would be the harm in making it mandatory, if holding everybody to the same standard of accountability? That was our question. The other thing that we noted was that in determining when the discretion, if the committee opts to continue with leaving it open with the discretion, the question then arises in what would be the pre-existing conditions that are required to be there for them to then make a choice to either refer it for criminal investigation or otherwise. What is the test? Is it an is it a subjective test or an objective test? You take the provisions of the what would then be the act and you apply it to the cold facts in front of you. What is the test? Because then if it becomes subjective, if it becomes open to personal interpretation, then we're leaving a door open for abuse and selective application. That was our concern. And we further think that if there is a subjective test that is expressed in the act, that doesn't leave me to apply my own interpretation and the next person to apply their own, then it will provide a sufficient legal mechanism to ensure that there is consistent application of the provision. Just to bring in from the comments that was made by my colleague, we are not inherently opposed to the referral for criminal investigation, as we'll see in our other point in here. The question that we have is that it states that it speaks of relevant investigating authorities. It would be better if they were identified as crimes, because we have the SIU, which is a kind of a unique institution. As it is, they can only take instruction from the President of the Republic. And we're not creating concurrent or perhaps competing authorities between the two centers of power in another center of authority. So it doesn't mean here that the SIU can take instructions from the Auditor General to initiate an investigation, that the Auditor General have that authority. I'll come back and elaborate more on that point. And then we come to the part of imputing personal liability. This one, again, is the definition of the debt and the definition of the debtor. And the debtor will be inclusive of accounting authorities. We assume that definition also includes, it refers to boards and members of the board and the accounting officer as well. Our concern about this part was that the Auditor General, in the absence of a satisfactory explanation, and then it goes silent on what is a satisfactory explanation. Then again, is it a subjective test or objective standard? Are we going to take, or what form does the evidence take that is required for the Auditor General to make a determination that there is satisfactory explanation here or there is no satisfactory explanation? And then we come to the question of imputing personal liability. I think the committee should take into account that most SOEs are huge in size, and that in most instances you find that even the accounting officer is not aware of
the mismanagement of funds, because obviously the person who will be doing such things will go to some extent to try and conceal what they have done. So it may not be immediately evident that some wrong has been done. And here we are seeking to impute strict liability on the person. So our view is that at least some element of culpa must be established. In this sense that we say, before the issue of the debt notice, death certificate, the agent must be satisfied that one, the accounting officer was aware. If awareness cannot be established, a person in his or her position should have been reasonably expected to be aware of it. But where we can establish that the person, no reasonable person, even if you're the best accounting officer ever, would have been aware of that misconduct, then that should also be considered, because it has huge personal implications for the people which we seek to hold accountable. We're not saying they must not be held accountable if that's the feeling of the committee, but at least we must raise the standard. There must be some element of culpa that is required instead of imputing strict liability, which requires no fault on the part of the person being held accountable. And then we come, I did raise the question of concurrent competency between the AG and the Office of the President. And we also note that we agreed here, as we're nodding our heads, that it's more of a question of enforcement that is lacking. And yet again, if you look at the other side of the coin, really do we expect accounting authorities to defend themselves for their own failure for criminal investigation? So that is why we feel that this is an appropriate measure to try and close that gap. Because if I'm sitting on the board and I know it's been noted by the AG that we have failed to execute our mandate, am I going to quickly run and go refer myself for a criminal investigation? I doubt that will happen, which is why we find that even though the MFMA and the PFMA have created this list of offences, there's very little enforcement, because I think that was where the wording of those previous acts fell short. You cannot expect a person to refer themselves for criminal investigation. And then our last bit of contribution, it comes to the persons that are being held accountable for failing to ensure that state resources are respected and used for the purpose that they're intended. The definition says it is inclusive of former accounting authorities, members of former accounting authorities, and former accounting officers. Now, it raises the question, is the intention of the committee to give legislation retrospective application? Is it intended to correct from this point going forward, or is it intended to even make right on the wrongs that were done before the act came into place? Because if we say former, if I was an accounting officer in 2000, before this thing came, by the time it's enacted, I will fall under that category of former. So the wording of that one, we advise that be looked into, and we are guided by the intention of this bill, because then it's a value call that the committee will have to make, because as we speak, the level of abuse of state resources is not halted, it's going on as we speak. So you have to make a choice that we forgive what happened until that day that the act is passed, or you expressly say, going back so many years, or it's an open-ended retrospective application. Thank you for your attention. We can take questions.
Many questions. I can tell you that already, but fine. I'll give members time to attach. Some of these we did cover before you came in our opening. will go over them. Do you think we're ambushing you if we start with the Honourable Nobel, or do you want us to change the sequence slightly?
Okay, can we change it slightly?
Can we change it slightly? Can we start with Mr. Singh and we'll go that way? I'll cover everything that you need to cover. That he gets up in the morning and he feels that he must refer, he doesn't refer. My understanding is that all of us, including you, if you're aware of a criminal act, you're duty bound to report it. So there's no discretion. You're duty bound to report it. And if the AG picks something up, he doesn't have the discretion of whether he must or whether he mustn't. He must. Now, if you want us to put it in the act, we'll put it in the act. But I just thought that it was the common cause that if he picks up corruption, he's duty bound to report it. So there's no grey area around that. But other members can touch that. Yes, the issue around the SIU, we did have a big fight with members of SCOPE. I don't know how we resolved it eventually, but we did pick that up, that we don't have the power to instruct the president. And if the president is in council, whatever the English word is, we might have a problem. So we might get back to that one. I thought you were confused, ma'am, around, you know, you guys are talking about the accounting authority and then you're talking about the board, and do you then want to punish the accounting authority and the board? The board is the accounting authority. The board is the accounting authority. So there's no confusion around those two where there's a board. It's the board that is going to pay the price. Again, you also said that somewhere the Auditor General spoke about he will continue, there's no satisfactory or whatever, something around satisfactory explanation. And your question was, but who determines satisfactorily? Well, the AG is an independent body. Like the judiciary and like the public protector. And in this respect, I suppose, satisfactory is his decision, but you always have the option of reviewing it if you don't think it's satisfactory. So there shouldn't be a concern about, well, why do we give the AG the right to decide what is satisfactory? If we disagree, we take it on review. So I think that's it, but you'll respond to these as we come along, and if you disagree, you'll disagree. So I'm just giving you the points as I see them. And somewhere else he said to us, you know, it might be unfair, it's a big organization, how are they accounting ourselves? Why do you expect the accounting authority to be aware of what's happening somewhere down the line? I've got two answers for that person. The first answer is that the buck stops with you as the accounting officer. You see, because you guys are very quick to say, yeah, but the buck stops with you, Mr. President. And the president says, but I'm not working in Rand Water, that is somewhere in Kibler Park. You're not going to accept it. You're going to say, you, the CEO of South African Corporation, whether you're in Kibler Park or not. So why is it the case here that you're saying, well, Randwood is a big organization. How do you expect Simon Lishaba when he was there to answer? Well, he must if he's the accounting authority. That's the first thing. The second thing is, the way we envisage this thing, the AG is going to come in on day one, pick up fruitless and wasteful expenditure, come to you as the accounting authority and say, I've picked this thing up. And when he comes around the second time, he says, I picked this up last year, Mr. Accounting Authority, what have you done about it? It's only then that this other remedial action kicks in. It's not when we pick it up now. Although if it was me and not the AG, I would have picked it up now. It's just very nice and keeps you 18 months. But that's how I envisage it. That 18 months down the line, you'll come and say, you still haven't acted on it. So it's not as if it's happening now. That's how I understand it, but my colleagues will help me if I'm not understanding it correctly. So yeah, I don't think it's at least 18 months. Then you raise the question that everybody raised, even we raised it, by the way. The AG refers this thing to the Hawks, and he must be kept informed of the progress. And I think it was raised even by our colleague next week. The debate that was unleashed when we did that was the dependency debate. Because for him to be informed, I'm assuming that he must be informed so that he must act. Now, once the AG is dependent on the executive, you take away his independence. And we were convinced that, look, he must give it to the Hawks must do what they must do. Take it, drive through to the NPA and wherever. And maybe the police or justice committee must handle it. But for the AG, and we haven't raised it with him because maybe he has the same view, but he's not hearing what we say. If the AG thinks that he must be given feedback by the executive, the argument is that he dilutes his independence. For him to, because the feedback will then determine whether he must act or not act. So that was the argument around must be kept informed. But if you feel otherwise, you can raise it with us. You also raised the issue around why don't you guys identify these investigating agents? Right? If we must say, we can't say in the bill that the AG must refer to the Hawks, so he must refer to the staff, so he must refer to, I'm saying outside of the SIU. I would imagine that can come into regulations if the AG feels strongly about it, but it certainly can't be part of the principle for the mother legislation. If at all it must come in, I would imagine that's where it must come in. Then you raise the issue, and I never thought about it at the time. You say, you see, Smith, this thing is going to come into effect in June. And there you're talking about former people. Does it mean that somebody that's committing a crime today is liable? My answer is yes. You know, if you follow what we do in Scopa, and there's some people here that serve with me in Scopa, my argument always has been, as long as you are alive, we're going to chase you. But I tell you why, because not only is it retrospective, but some of you leave water and then you go and serve in correctional services. Once we start investigating in water, you go to correctional services. When we investigate in correctional services, you go to the legislature. And up to now we said, well, he or she is no longer in the department, there's nothing we can do. Smith is saying, as long as you're alive, we're going to come and find you. So let us be just very clear on that one. There's not going to be this argument that it's now. You've committed a crime. Unless it's prescribed, therefore you can't pay it back and those type of things, that's fine. But I don't think you're going to get off the hook because you committed a crime yesterday and we've only brought this law into effect today. It's not going to work. That's not my understanding. Ntombela, anything you want to add up?
Thank you, Chair.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm breaking my own rule. We're going this way now. Sing and then
okay.
The class call and you'll be the last to do that.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. No, you've covered a lot of ground. But I must say I'm a bit concerned and maybe you can expand a little more to one of your statements here, 5.23, where you say it is further not clear whether such determination will be drawn from the subjective observations of the Auditor General or an application of objective standards or existing facts. Now, I've been serving on SCOFA for 25 years. I won't tell you how many years, but many, many years, along with Smith and others. And we've always valued the reports and that emerge from the Office of the Auditor General as being objective. I've always realized that whenever they bring a report to us that they make public, it's a product that has been thoroughly engaged with the entity or with the department. So I can't see where the subjectivity comes in from. It casts a bit of doubt in my mind onto how you view the Office of the Auditor General when you say, whether the determination will be drawn from subjective observation. Of course, in recent times we found that not the Office of the Auditor General, but private auditing firms, well-known auditing firms, and I can mention them and you can mention them, you know them, that might even be doing your audit, have not been doing their work properly. So to that extent, you may have some kind of an argument, but I'd really like you to expand so that I have certainty in my mind that, you know, the Office of the Auditor General that we've been working with for the last 20 years, since 1994, is objective whenever they make a finding. And further to that, you see, their finding is also subject of scrutiny by your scopers, provincial scopas, your national scopas, your MPACs, which further interrogate their findings. And if it is found after evidence is led
that an accounting authority can explain a fruitless or a wasteful expenditure. We condone that. And Parliament's known to have condoned hundreds of millions of rand of that kind of expenditure. But where they found to be frequent disregard of financial management and gross irregularity, then obviously that's the area where we expect the AG's office to say, let us go for this individual. And why the accounting authority is, because the accounting authority is ultimately responsible for what happens within their own department. So I just like to understand this thinking from the side of land water, not your thinking from the side of land water. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. You rightly said you covered most of the ground anyway, but I just wanted to answer a few things. You asked about satisfactory explanation. You decided. We're not trying to sort of reinvent the wheel here. We're not changing the AG's reason for existence. This is just, in the course of an audit, he comes across things. And normally he will ask questions, and he will get explanations. If that explanation is satisfactory, that's the end of it. It's only where it's an unsatisfactory explanation in the terms of doing an audit that he can then make a decision on that. So I don't think it's a big issue. It's in the terms of doing an audit. He gets explanations, one or the other, on every question he asks of the management or whoever he's dealing with. So in my opinion, that's what it covers. It's an ordinary explanation that would be acceptable to the AG in carrying out his functions. You also raised the issue on why go for the accounting officer? There must be some element of blame on his part before he can be held liable. I don't think it's necessarily the case, because the accounting officer by definition is responsible for this. And there's nothing to stop him. If he's sued, he can join any co-defendants he likes to say, well, I'm going to shift the responsibility onto these guys because I actually know they're the responsible ones, and then he must prove it. But in terms of his employment agreement, whatever it might be, he's the guy who's liable, so you have to go for him. Who else are you going to go for in terms of the BFMA? He's the responsible party. He's entitled, as I say, to cite co-defendants or do whatever he needs to do to spread the load, but that's within his realm. And then lastly, just on your question of retrospective application, you asked, does it mean this or does it mean that? As the chairman has said, it means both, in my understanding. So it affects both the suggestions you find all in both.
Honourable Carter?
She's out. You see, the most unfortunate part of the change of sequence is that the chairperson takes everything.
I warned you.
Then just when I thought I've got something left in me, then you gave honorable thing and honorable stuff. Then they decimated me. So thank you so much. I don't have nothing to say.
I promise we'll start to do in the next one.
Over to that one.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think the essence of our commentary is embedded in the legal drafting and what we term interpretation of statutes. We do not want to allow a bill to become an act and at a later stage have issues around the interpretation thereof. The questions we're asking about the test, the burden of proof, evidential burden, are as a result of the choice in wording in terms of the act. And you would understand this. I mean, in recent times we have seen, and I know that the committee has been very strong ensuring that the Auditor General is not challenged legally by entities of the state. If you produce the kind of legislation that is either permissive and not mandatory, this is what will then result. You will have to now re-look at the budgetary provisions of the AGs that we all agree currently are very minimal, and you will now have to provide for legal costs to empower them to be able to protect the legislation. So I'm actually basically saying, let us agree on a theme of our presentation to the committee. The theme is that the choice of legal writing, the drafting, the choice of words, it must be inherent at this stage that it is either shall, must, mandatory and objective. So those are the issues that we're talking to. So I really wanted the committee to understand that, because we legal people are in business. And I'm talking about my colleagues that are not serving the state, but that are in private practice. They will take this to courts to go and deal with the interpretation, and it becomes a long, drawn argument of what could have been dealt with at this current stage. So that is what I would respectfully submit that the drafters of the bill consider. You would want to make sure that you close all those loopholes at this initial stage, so we do not have a problem. I will just hand over to my colleagues. I'll continue. And I want you to please just note that. The issue of the accounting authority, we understand. And the reason we raise it is that depending on the institution of government, you might have a board, you might not have a board. And it is important that we respectfully submit that an inference is drawn that members of the board are also liable in this regard. So it is important for us to make that interpretation, and it needs to be understood. Perhaps I should just allow Lebo to also... The retrospective nature is also a legal issue. We were taught in law school, advocate, I'm saying advocate now, Auditor General, that the legislation is not retrospective. We were taught in law school that legislation is not retrospective. So what in essence we're saying is that are we now as a country fundamentally changing the principle, the legal jurisprudence of South Africa to include the retrospective application of the law? That is a fundamental legal jurisprudence question that we're asking. And if you look at any legislation in the country, you will find that there is no legislation that is retrospective in application. Thank you.
Chairperson, if I may respond, it's not a response as such, the response as such, Chairperson, but just to clarify a few things. Perhaps because we are pressed for time, we just ran over some things without going into greater detail of our interpretation of the bill as it stands. I think my GGE has covered a lot of the aspects. Like we said in our detailed comments, we are not opposed to the amendments. We fully support the amendments. But ours is to ensure that the loopholes are closed, that there are no comebacks in the application of the intended amendments. And if it is so that the bill is intended to retrospective application, let it be explicit that the bill has retrospective application. On the question of the accounting officer, I think the explanation by the chairperson kind of covers that element. It was not our submission that the accounting officer should not be held accountable, but it was such that there must be an element of showing that he failed to execute his duty, and that failure is in law culpa. That is a requirement, as opposed to strict liability, where it doesn't matter whether I failed to do what I was supposed to have done, knowingly or unknowingly. That is the distinction that we wanted to draw to the attention of the committee. But then if the chairperson says the intention is that only when he has become aware, then it answers our question. Because really to hold someone accountable for something that they were not aware of would be something. But the issuing of instruction by the AG that you need to act on this, then you cannot escape and say I was not aware. Then that instance will establish awareness, and then liability will follow from that. That was our question, our comment. Respectfully,
would like to submit that we are not in any way questioning the integrity of the office of the AG. Our comment on the question of satisfactory was more on the issue of the standard of proof. Is it the oral submissions, is it an interpretation of accounting books, and then from that do we take the undesirable outcome as sufficient standard to say there's an undesirable outcome that has not been acted on, therefore we proceed. This amounts to lack of satisfactory explanation. That is why we said if it will help the process and ensure that everything is covered, we only request that the Act stipulate the aim that A, B, C, and D will amount to lack of satisfactory standard. And just to reiterate and to thank you for the opportunity to present our comments, we are in the public service. It's a choice. We want to serve South Africa. We did not land there by default. Therefore, we are committed to ensuring that we help the process, like GGE said, to build South Africa, to strengthen its institutions, and to make sure that we are all accountable for our actions. Thank you.
All right. You know, some of us are not lawyers, but we grew up in hard times, so we take our chances. Let me do that with you lawyers. Take my chance on the issues that you've raised, just the one issue. I first of all thank you very much for the legal clarity that you think is required so that it's not challengeable. Can I suggest that, time permitting, if you guys identified areas where you think there is clarity, if you send it to us, we're not going to be opposed to it from where it comes. That's the first one. You know, on this one of retrospective, I was quickly trying to go through here. And like I said, I'm not a lawyer. I just come from Westbury, where there's lots of gangsters. We didn't go to school. You know, somewhere in the Constitution, it says that whatever government does, I'm sure it's in the Constitution, it must be equitable, free, competitive, and those type of things. It says so. Yeah, it says that in the Constitution. And this is the supreme law of the land. Now, the Auditor General comes and he says, on the basis of what the Constitution requires, I am judging that the actions of Vincent Smith were out of order. If that's all he's doing, he's in the main looking at supply chain management. So he comes and he says, the Constitution says it must be competitive, it was not competitive. This Constitution was adopted in 1996, I think. So is it retrospective or is it not retrospective when you say, I'm applying the Constitution? I'm not a lawyer. I can just imagine myself standing in front of Mugeng Mugeng. That would be my argument. That all he's doing is implementing the Constitution. Is it retrospective because Smith and his committee said to him, you've not been doing this up to now, go ahead and do it. We've not asked him to change anything in the Constitution. All we've said, we don't think you're doing your job. Do your job. I'm just asking the question. Would that be a loophole for us? If it's not, if retrospective is in fact correct, lawyers there must be able to come back and tell us, Fatima, everybody, but I'm just giving you my Bush mentality, that he's implementing the Constitution, and there's no law that can come here and supersede the Constitution. So that was my argument on retrospective, but if I'm wrong, like I said, I'm very humble, I'll withhold it. If I'm wrong, I withdraw. All the others, thank you very much for your information. Any last round, and you guys will come back and challenge us again. Let's start with Ntombela, and we'll come
okay.
One question
yeah.
For each member, and then you guys will have a second bite.
Thank you, Chairperson. Can I also take advantage of this occasion?
Yeah.
Yes. On the issue of the accounting officers, it's the very first time for me to hear that this thing about ignorance of the law is not an excuse for a transgression. It's the very first time for me to hear that it's not necessarily like that. We're talking about the accountability of the accounting officers here. And our understanding is that, like the chairperson has said at the beginning, the buck stops at your table. It becomes his responsibility to make sure that he accounts for all levels of his administration. But you have just said that you gave me an impression that it's not necessarily the case. Shall I clarify on that?
Honourable Mafahman?
Thank you, Chair. Just on your point, unlike my chairperson, I am a lawyer. And I would just pose the question to you. I don't believe it is registered, because what you're saying is the accounting officer has always been liable, no matter when the crime has come into existence. Corruption has always been a crime. Theft and fraud have always been crimes. We're not reinventing the wheel here. What we're saying is when the AG makes a finding and says there was some kind of misdemeanor occurred there when the previous accounting officer was in office, therefore he must be liable. So it's not retrospective, it's just that you discover it now, and all we're saying is that even though this law is only coming into effect now, it still applies to those who might previously have been in position. Can you answer me on that? Because I don't see why you are saying it's retrospective. I'm saying not. The issue at stake is not retrospective. It was always a crime. And all we're saying is we're discovering it now. Now, AG has got an additional power to say that person is responsible. It's always been the case, but we're just enforcing it now to say that AG may do it. And then secondly, on the accountability of the accounting officer, would you agree with me that he's only going to be liable if he's either in breach of contract or if it complies with all of the laws for liability under the Board dealing? If those two things aren't there, he can't be liable. We can't make new law here to say that in different circumstances outside of those, suddenly he's liable. It's only if he's guilty in terms of those existing laws that he would be liable. Thank you.
Yeah, Chair, thank you. I'm just trying to follow up on this retrospective and get my understanding correct. So he was the audit report that finally emerges and that's interrogated is the subject of an ex post facto action. It's an action that took place a year ago. You've got your financial statements, then you have your audit, and then you come up with a report. So how does retrospective and that tie in? Because it is the action you're going to take on the accounting officer is on something that happened previously. So I'm just trying to understand.
Thank you, members of the committee. I think the amendment as it reads, for us, the emphasis of the former was create the application with retrospective effect. And what we're saying is that it then may result in the retrospective application as you understand it. And therefore, and I did say that the theme of our submission is in the legal drafting. Therefore, it will need to be stipulated in the legislation that whether current or former, because the question is if indeed by burden of by the onus is proof that it is not the current accounting officer but the former, and not the accounting officer that is current accounting authority that is currently in office but the former. So for us, we needed to be certain of what is it that is being implied. And really, this is in the drafting. And members of parliament, let us be cautious of the fact that we can draft and agree as public institutions. But when there's a challenge, these questions will arise. And therefore, we need to be very, you know, any lawyer, the minute you say retrospective, they jump to, what are you actually saying? Are you therefore then saying this act, it must be implied in the act, that this act has a retrospective effect, so that there is no challenges with regards to that. And perhaps just as a member of the executive, I think it needs to be said unequivocally that the issue of the accounting officer is such that, you are right, ignorance of the law is no excuse. And an accounting officer is expected to know what happens in their entity. If that was the understanding of the committee, please pardon us, it wasn't the understanding. The question is, it may arise that through certain, because you know that we've got combined assurance and certain things may not necessarily be covered by the first line, by the second line, by the third line, by the fourth line of defense, and only by the fifth line, which is the AG. So that is the question, that as we deal with the accounting officer at that stage, we should actually take cognizant of the fact that, I mean, for instance, issues of collusion, which may not necessarily be apparent in terms of the first, second, third, fourth, and line of defense, but the AG is able to address them. Then therefore we should also take into consideration that the accounting officer may only have had the opportunity to know about it when the AG made it known to him. But now you're saying, which for me is a good issue, is that if in 18 months the issue is not addressed, then we have an issue with that. But currently institutions, I mean, I run the audit matrix of my institution. I have a risk and a register of the findings, consequence management, which may result in criminal and civil action. So I may just say that in my institution, chances of us being of AG having to use this legislation is really minimal, because we really ensure that the consequence management is reported to those entrusted with governance. Thank you.
McLaughlin and others might take me to jail, but Ms. Stalling, you know, I'm so impressed with Rand Watch's legal officers here. I mean, you raised the level of debate here. Can I come and do my articles with you from next week? where I do my articles with you guys?
Chairperson, you're welcome. However, in line with Section 217, we had advertised last year and we had called for candidates, attorneys, so we would follow that process. We do not want our council authority to answer to SCOPA. And I see we've got our corporate executive in charge of our account, Ms. Alice Muller, sitting on my other side, so let us follow process. Thank you very much.
But I don't want to see Joburg, and I'm from Joburg, and you're tall. AG, you want to say something?
Yes, Chair. Just on the point that the colleagues from Redwater were raising, I just wanted to, and I've been thinking about this issue of retrospective, I don't know what the answer is, but if you think about it, there are times when someone presides over a position as an accounting officer, and that possibly is at the stage of the development of the policy, which is yet to be implemented. And it has happened, and it does happen, that they then get out of government, enter into a business relationship with other existing people who've now already geared themselves for implementation of that policy. Now, you go through this investigation, you figure out that X was the accounting officer, is directly responsible for that particular transaction where supply chain management precedents were clouded. But now they are a supplier. That's the one example. But the other example is also the long-term nature of a lot of these infrastructure projects. It's possible that at the feasibility stage, when awards were being made in preparation for implementation of a long-term asset, an accounting officer would have been responsible and in the driving seat in that institution in the process of the award, may, because of passage of time, no longer be in the system, either their term has expired, but they were responsible for the origin or the genesis of the matter, which is the subject of the certificate, at the time that they were an accounting officer. How do you apply the principle that we were talking about with regards to retrospective in those peculiar circumstances, which are prevalent in quite a number of public sector institutions?
Thank you, Chair. The quality of the people from Renwood, who are now fighting to answer questions. I actually wanted to say initially, when the issue of retrospective effect was raised, that for me, I read this in depth, and I actually thought it's a moot topic. And the Honourable Member, who's a legal practitioner, would understand. I think there's more depth in this, in the demagogy. We should actually re-look at this and understand what are we actually saying in this regard. For instance, I am aware that as per PFMA, as per the legislation that governs the procurement, the accounting officer is ultimately responsible for supply chain. But if you test the governance and the SCM governance of an institution, and you have committees that the accounting officer is put in place, whether it's the bid specification, the bid evaluation, the bid adjudication, and that is part of strengthening governance. What the accounting officer is doing, the demagogy, is ensuring that they uplift the standard of governance so that in any of the transactions there is no direct line in terms of the ultimate letter of award. So in our institution, the example I'm making is that you do not find an accounting officer. Of course, at the end of the day, the decisions go to him. They have gone through a seven-step compliance process where he needs to test each and every. But there shouldn't be an accounting officer who's making that decision on an individual basis. But if it indeed it can be proven from a criminal test beyond reasonable doubt that the accounting officer was indeed instrumental in the award, then there would be a question, in my view, in terms of liability. And perhaps I would like to encourage the drafters to perhaps relook at the issue of retrospective nature and these issues that we are raising here. There is depth in the issues. And hence, if you look at our slide label, I don't know, slide where we talk about the burden of proof in legal terms is a very important issue. We're not saying the accounting officer should therefore say, I was not responsible. From a PFMA, he is the ultimate. But from a governance perspective, we always ensure that there are layers in terms of ensuring that there's independence, the governance is intact, so that at the end of the day, that letter of award that is issued is not dependent on only the decision of the accounting officer. Ms. Muller has been exposed to the governance we practice in Redwater. It does comply with legislation in that the accounting officer ultimately makes that appointment. However, the SCM governance AG is such that it goes beyond the normal standards in terms of ensuring a best practice. Thank you.
All right, there's Freshchi outside. Once again, like we said to everybody before, please, Guy, I'm using guys, both, what do you call it, gender, not gender sensitive, but please, colleagues, multi, or whatever. If, as you're flying home, driving home, there's some of these things, please, you are free to advise. This is something that's important for us. Just on the accounting authority, and I'm not opening a debate, not at all. You know, like I said, we come from the bush. When Parliament interacts with the AG's work, we interact with the annual report, which includes the financial report, which is signed by the accounting authority. So all these things about governance committee, audit committee, they fine. But you know, when it comes to Smith, you've signed this document. You take ownership for this document. But I take the point that I think it gives us a bit of comfort that we've got all these things that are happening, the audit committee and all those type of things. But at the end of the day, for me, it's the accounting authority. And as you say, it's a seventh step. If after seven steps the accounting authority still brings trash to me, then he doesn't deserve my respect. He doesn't deserve my respect. But thank you. Leave your numbers with us, leave our numbers with you. I'll come and visit Redwater. I promise you. I'll come and visit Redwater. Thank you very much. Who's your chair of the board?
Advocate,
Okay, absolutely. Last one, we are running out of time. Yes.
Chair, we've presented a written document. However, as we indicated earlier on, we are here to serve. For the issues that you've raised, we are available. Thank you.
I thank you so much, Redwater. The program, honourable members, is we go to Dr. Nidus. You can talk from there if you wish. You can come nearer. It's absolutely up to you. Dr. Nidus' presentation is in your pack, honourable members. As with everybody else, Dr. Nidus, you will do your presentation and then be prepared to defend it.
Thank you, Chair, and the committee for affording me this opportunity to make an oral submission. I'm here to seek practical solutions. I'm an advocate, an arbitrator, a mediator, and a current board member of a national public entity. I'm here in my personal capacity as an issue advocate. I've been a public servant employed in the presidency between 2003 and 2007, so I see the problem and the possible solutions from the inside and as a citizen. I welcome the amendments, but do not think that they go far enough. I need more time to reflect on this because it has a direct impact on me. The PSMA, the MFMA, the Public Audit Act, the Public Service Act, the Prevention of Corrupt Activities Act all need to be amended. On the one hand, there's too much red tape. On the other hand, there's too little less enforcement, and that can minimize fraud and corruption. The National Treasury, the Provincial Treasury, the DPSA, and Parliament have to exercise their oversight roles more effectively. The AG is the supreme audit institution mandated by the Constitution. Acts of Parliament have, in practice, but not in law, obviously, because the hierarchy in the Constitution reigns supreme. These acts have diluted the powers. The AG should be the only external auditor for public entities at all spheres. Ranwater has been since called, described itself as a state-owned entity. There are actually no state-owned entities. You either have state-owned companies or you have public entities at different levels. I think that needs to be understood very, very carefully. The Auditor General already has the power to delegate his power to the Deputy AG, the AG staff, or an authorized auditor. So this amendment will not necessarily discriminate against registered auditors in the public sector. Section 4.3 affords the AG a discretionary power to decide whether to audit a public entity in practice. There appears to be a reversal of roles in that entities invite tenders by way of an advertisement, make the decision, and then the name of the auditor is submitted to the AG for approval. Regardless of who selects the auditor, the contractual relationship with the auditor from the auditor that's from the private sector lies with the public entity. This places a huge responsibility on board members as the accounting authority who are ultimately accountable for that contract that must be approved by the board. An amendment of Section 4 by the deletion of subsection 4.3 and the addition of public public entities and others listed in 4.3 subsection 4.1 will ensure that all public audits are done under the direct control and supervision of the AG. The AG can in turn exercise this discretionary power in terms of Section 12 to delegate his power to be the auditor to an authorized auditor. Section 25 of the Act also needs to be amended to exclude the opt-out clause. Section 3 of the amendment bill again confers a discretionary power on the AG and the auditee, and this allows many public entities to opt out of these audit services that will ensure that resources are procured economically and utilized efficiently and effectively. The proposed section 5B1A again does not cover the auditors and auditees who opt out of the audit. I think that's very, very important, because if you think that if you look at Schedule 2, Schedule 1 and Schedule 2 of the PFMA, it lists these constitutional institutions and state-owned companies. But all these other companies, entities, public entities, at every sphere of government, they have this choice. The auditor has to opt out, and therefore I'd just like to read it so that I do not, I'll answer your question. So the word audit must not be used indiscriminately. Only an authorized auditor has the legal power and right to perform an audit function. Governments, the media, and civil society often use the word audit when they are describing other activities. The amended act should make this very clear and prohibit the use of the word audit, except as defined in the act. For instance, a newspaper article this week refers to an HR manager doing audits on himself by way of a consultancy contract in the Department of Water Affairs. There's also a document published in the Government Gazette on land audits by rural development and land affairs. But this is a compilation of statistics and not an audit. So we must be very careful. Section 1 of the Public Audit Act defines audit as the examination or investigation in accordance with applicable audit standards of those aspects to be reported on in terms of Section 20 or 28. I propose that the definition be amended and that an audit must always be performed by an authorized but registered auditor. Section 12 of the Public Audit Act must be amended to differentiate the kind of auditing services. If it is an internal audit of public entities, then it can be done by the unregistered staff of the AG or a private practitioner who is unregistered with the IRBA, but who has the prerequisite qualifications, experience, and competence. Or an accountant may be permitted to audit, for example, a state school, subject to further training in the PFMA and procurement legislation. But it is critically important that the external audit requirements of the PFMA or MFMA be performed by the Auditor General, who may delegate this power only to registered auditors who have in-depth knowledge and understanding of the PFMA and MFMA. This is critical. The IRBA must also revise its education and training curriculum. Many auditors apply the Companies Act to all public entities, which is incorrect. These public entities are registered with the Registrar of Public Entities at the National Treasury and must comply with the PFMA and Public Audit Act, among others. This is a very serious problem. Sections 12 and 25 need to be amended, as there is a reference to the Public Accountants and Auditors Act, which has been repealed and replaced by the Auditing Professions Act of 2005. So this is why I feel it's not covering, the current bill does not cover everything. There are inconsistencies, such as Section 12B of the Public Audit Act refers to a private practitioner, then goes on to use the term public practice, the same term used in the Auditing Profession Act 2005. Yet by comparison with other professionals, this kind of practice would be considered private practice. Section 15(1) of the Public Audit Act confers sweeping, broad powers on the Auditor General, including any delegated authorized auditor. That's Section 48(1)(c). If the Auditor General opts out and does not audit a public entity, as in the case in my case, then the entity auditor must appoint, in terms of Section 21(b), a person registered in terms of the Public Accountants and Auditors Act, which is of course now repealed. It's the Auditing Profession Act, and engaged in public practice as such. Those registered auditors under the Auditing Profession Act do not have such sweeping powers. Perhaps this is where some of the problems affecting public entities arise. Such appointments are restricted to 1 year, but in practice, appointments by public entities are being made for 5 years in line with the Companies Act, which does not, in fact, apply to public entities, except those public entities which are state-owned companies. This is confusing to me. which law is applicable. There appears to be a disconnect between the office of the AG and public entities that fall under section 4.3.b.2, Roman numeral 2. The Public Audit Act must be amended to provide clarity and certainty. The proposed amendment, as at section 2 of the bill, perpetuates the problem, rather than supporting the objectives of this amendment bill. Section 37 of the Act should also include the Treasury regulations regarding investment accounts by the AG. Undesirable audit outcome and lawful purpose. Examples of lawful purpose could be litigation, appointment, arbitrary promotion, arbitrary job evaluation, arbitrary remuneration with a higher salary than advertised for that job classification, lawfully authorized by the Public Service Act as amended in 2007, and the PFMA, as well as small and medium-sized tenders. This is where fruitless and wasteful expenditure is undetected because of the compliance with laws that have loopholes and which confer wide discretionary powers to management. Auditors will find it very difficult to detect this and report it as fruitful and wasteful expenditure and loss of public resources. Another problem relating to compliance is where all the paperwork complies with the PFMA, Public Service Act, and other laws. And an application for condemnation in respect of fruitless and wasteful expenditure or irregular expenditure is made to the National Treasury or the Provincial Treasury, and regardless of approval of the NT, the debt cannot be recovered. And then this is written off. This is quite common. The current amendment bill does not address this issue, as all of the above are done in the name of lawful purpose. Are auditors trained to detect inflated tenders, construction contracts, irregular contracts, and so on? And this is Tasima versus the Department of Transport, Bombela, the Caltrain, and so on. They are all irregular contracts, but they were lawfully signed. Are all auditors trained to detect non-compliance of public record management and archiving or records, including emails? And the emails are important, because in the private sector, people think that emails are not important. They don't have to record it. But in terms of the Public Records Management Act, it's normal. It is the law. But so this is something that you need to look into. The King Code, 4 Code, is a blessing, but also an impediment for board members.
Sorry, Dr. Nadi.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you. You know, the difficulty we have now is that we had your submission, and that's what members highlighted.
Well,
and the stuff that you're raising now, members have not had an opportunity to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really not going to be a meaningful interaction. And members can guide me if they think it's going to be, but it's new information that we would have to internalize. And as I said to colleagues before you came, this committee was subjected to going through all the submissions on Friday to clarify all these things
mm-hmm.
that we were going through. It's just going to raise challenges to me. I'm not sure how my colleagues see it, but the new information is going to be very difficult. I don't know, ma'am, and honourable members, that if that information can be made public, I mean, brought to us, in our interactions we can internalize it and take it. It's just so much new stuff that you're talking about now that I'm not sure that I would even be able to interact with you intelligently even now. I'm saying I was trying to make notes of what you're talking about. I'm not sure, but I'm looking at members. I wouldn't want us to waste too much time if it's not going to be helpful. Let's find a better way. I think the information is relevant, but how do we process it? If you can give us just 2 minutes, ma'am. I'm looking at my colleagues. If we can must continue, I have no problem. Any comments? Yes, Honorable.
Yeah, Chairperson, thank you very much. No, I think there's some very useful but technical information that's very difficult for our brains to absorb this moment in time. So maybe we should take in the presentation when it's completed, if it's in a written form, and then we'll consider it as we move forward. And if need be, if Dr. Naidoo has come back to clarify anything, I suppose we can do that. Except for the public entities thing, which I noted here and I made some points. I think the very little else I can ask at this moment in time on the presentation itself. So maybe we need a hard copy, if you've got one.
Yeah,
to the committee, and then we can digest it and take it from there.
Anybody, any other comments?
No.
All right. If we go that route, honourable members, there's just one condition, ma'am, is that that would have to be given to us before Friday, because the AG responds on Friday, and in his response, or he responds next week, and in his response, we'd want to get his comments on it. So if you do give it to us, you must give it sufficient time for us to look at it, and also to afford the AG an opportunity to look at it and comment on it. So I'm not sure how much longer your presentation is. And secondly, please give it to us in writing. You can email it to us, we'll make sure we circulate it.
Chair, my apologies, because I did discuss with your PA, and I did indicate that I wrote an email in haste, you know, because I just discovered this amendment bill, and I made comments. I asked, could I expand? And for instance, I'm writing as I speak because I'm talking about practical issues. It's all very well to talk about theory. It's all very well talking about enforcing fraud and corruption, you know, issues. I'm trying to give you solutions and also to point out, for instance, there are huge inconsistencies between the two pieces of legislation. And yeah. I think it's very important to look at it. So when I asked, I did request that when I come, I would like to expand. And but I said in my emails, this is an expansion. And unfortunately, I am writing as I speak because I cannot give you a consolidated input, you know, in 5 minutes.
What are you suggesting we do, ma'am? How do you suggest we take the...
Well, I think that's why it's not just recovery. You know, I thought if I just made my presentation and then you ask me questions, I would expand on that. But at the moment, because I could talk at great length, you know, right as we speak, there's a CCMA hearing, you know, dealing with forensic audits. You know, we have gone through many problems, and these are not entities that you're talking about. Most of the discussion is about state-owned companies. There is a big difference. You know, people are not even aware. You can have board members, staff, the IOD, everyone giving wrong information. They are training people incorrectly. So you have nearly 700 entities not even on your radar screen at the moment. So if you take, for instance, 1 million rands of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, you multiply it by 700, you'll get 700 million which you could save. You know, so there are a number of issues here. And I truly believe that, for instance, a few weeks ago, I had to sit at a meeting. And we had to get a recommendation to discharge auditors or to ask the Auditor General. To me, who takes responsibility for that, first of all? Why should we be wasting our time when the focus should be on service delivery? When it should be the Auditor General who could appoint the person, appoint this authorized auditor, and then when there are problems, the Auditor General terminates that appointment. And I think that, you see, if you don't understand what I'm saying, I think then it's very, very serious.
No, ma'am, it's not that we don't understand what you're saying. There's the way we work in this committee, and all committees. And I think fairness to everybody here, for an interaction to be meaningful, there needs to be, in fact, in all committees that I serve on, let me put you that way, I don't accept any presentation unless it's come to the committee 3-7 days before the time. I've never, everybody that comes to me knows, simply because, and let me tell you why, man, public servants have the habit, and I'm not saying you, have the habit of coming with information the eve before the meeting and expect me to do meaningful oversight. It's just, as you're saying, you're talking about practical things, let's put the practical things on the table. You cannot come here, not you, I'm saying generally, as a civil servant, come and give us a document on Friday and expect us to deal with it on Saturday. And everybody that works with me knows it. It's because we want to read, and it's because we want to have a meaningful interaction. So,
Chair, Chairperson.
You are right when you say that it's a problem if we don't understand what you're saying. I'm saying to you that it's not that we don't understand what you're saying. It's that we've not had sight of what you're saying. And because we've not had sight, we aren't able to have a meaningful discussion. Everything that you're putting there probably and in all likelihood would help us. But how do we take it and incorporate it if we aren't even able to engage with you and ask you questions? And that's the practical problem that we have. Cindy was putting in my ear that the reason we only gave you 10 minutes was because, and everybody has been given time on the basis of their submission. Others have got 15 minutes, others have got 10 minutes. We had a one-page presentation, and that is why it was 10 minutes, and we booked the room on that basis, and we do all those things. That's why I'm asking you, how do we take the process forward? I want to suggest, Matt, that please email that stuff to us. If it means that we must call you back prior to the AG or prior to our finalization to have a discussion with you, we should. There's something that I will challenge you on. I mean, you're not the expert on everything.
No.
Absolutely. So I would want to challenge you on many of those things. But I can't now because I haven't seen it. AG can't because she hasn't seen it and nobody else can. Can I suggest that you give it us in writing? I'll allow you to finish whatever you need to say, but can we have it in writing so that we then engage on a meaningful discussion? I know we've got until 12:30 in this venue, and I have still got, we'll give you. Believe me, we will give you some time. So can we ask, ma'am, that we allow you about 5 minutes just to wrap up whatever you're doing. Give it us in writing, we will make time to have an engagement with you. I'm looking at our members, if that's acceptable to you. Or 5 minutes, we have to try and give us a flavor of what your iPad or laptop, because we haven't even seen it. If you just give us a flavor, we can then decide how much time, when, and how do we interact.
Chair, first of all, I'm not here as a public servant. I'm here as a citizen. I think that's a very important thing to understand. I feel that it's important to share these views. So I took my time, my money to come here. I think that's very, very good. There's no NGO backing me. There's no donor. I cannot come back here. But I did engage with your office and say that I have more to say. And could I say it? And then I was invited for this commission. So I think it's unfair to say that I'm a public servant and I should be doing this. I'm a citizen.
No. We were giving you examples, ma'am, of what we do with public servants. We are
yes.
citizens.
So all I'm doing is I'm looking at something and then thinking. And I'm writing. I was writing at 1 o'clock in the morning. Because I'm looking at this and realizing, you know, you could rush through this bill, but you need to think it's through. Because what is the purpose of the bill? It's not just to go after fraud and corruption, because you have the Prevention of Corrupt Activities Act as well. It's how do we deal with current issues, for instance, with these other entities? I think most of the discussion that has come up has been with state-owned companies. You know, and the public awareness of fraud and corruption. But I don't believe that the public entities that are only registered with the Register of Public Entities have been dealt with. I'll be quite happy to send you this incomplete notes of mine. You know.
Honorable Singh, we'll come back to you in answers. But let me just put it this way, ma'am. You know, you're making life very difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're saying you've got incomplete notes that you're writing as we're speaking now. I'm humbly asking, how do we engage with something that you're busy doing as you speak, and you expect us to respond to it? You've got an AG's office that is taking notes. You've got my own legal team that is supposed to take notes. And I don't want their suggestions, but it makes it extremely difficult for MPs to try and engage with something that somebody is doing now. So I'm not sure, Fatima, how you guys suggest we handle it. I'm not sure, AG, but I can certainly tell you from our side, it's not going to assist us that we are taking information that we are hearing happening as we speak now. Because then it's an open debate. And if you want to have an open debate, then let's have that open debate. But it just makes life very difficult for us in terms of the processes that we follow. Maybe, Fatima, if there's any suggestions. No. Honorable Singh wanted to say something, Fatima, and then we'll give you the last say, yeah, man.
Let's hear the suggestion first, yeah.
Okay. Fatima, or AG, and it's not about, it's just about the process, because all of us on the same side. We need a product that must be sent to the House at a certain date. How do we do that? If you've got any comments, Fatima, any comments, AG, and then Singh will be the last. If you've got any comments in terms of suggestions, and then we'll come back to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. I think that the issues raised are certainly new. They're not covered in the existing amendments, as far as I understand, but they certainly do sound important. And if it is an opportunity for us to change those additional provisions while we are busy amending the Act, then certainly then we must pay heed to that and try to do it in this process. Chair, we have planned to have more than one workshop together with the AG's office, so we would welcome that submission in writing. We can interrogate it together with them, with our content advisor, with National Treasury if they have a role, and then we can feedback to the committee, and if you're open to a chair, maybe we could engage with Dr. Naidu directly on some of those issues. But it sounds to me as if they're quite technical, and I'm sure Melissa would agree that you may need your technical expertise within your own office to assist you in unpacking. Thanks, Chair.
Hey, Jim, if anything?
Chair, I think listening to Dr. Naidu, I can only say that any feedback is useful to us. The fact that the committee has got a specific remit on this matter is probably the limitation. But if there are things that somebody has pondered around the Public Audit Act, they will always be useful to us as feedback. What we do with them will be another subject. But I think it will be worthy of looking at whatever submission Dr. Naidu wants to share with us. But considering that what I've heard so far seems to be an entire overhaul of the Public Audit Act together with other related instruments, I don't think that was the original remit. But for purposes of engaging with the thinking, we certainly will not have a problem with getting that feedback. So we can also see what does this mean. Because there may be well areas here that we may need to explain to Dr. Naidu, as the people who are on the code phase. As I've listened, I've already got a few explanations to straighten up some of the stuff up there. So I think that could help if we were to get the document. Then we can have a separate engagement while the committee takes into account the things that are relevant for it in processing this specific bill.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think it would have been ideal for us as members of this committee to have engaged with Dr. Naidu as we've engaged with everybody else. But remember, we are not technical people. We are not legal people. We've got advocates here. We've got all sorts of qualified people here who will advise us. So I think I would support what you said, Chair. If it's unusual that a committee does this, but through the Chair, we could allow Dr. Naidu to engage with our legal team and the Office of the Auditor General and let them make a presentation to us on what she said. And if we feel they need to call her to expand on some of the issues from a political point of view, then we can probably make that arrangement. But I must say, Dr. Naidu, there's no rush on our side to get this bill before Parliament. We've got to do a thorough job, and there's certainly no rush. We're not constrained by any time frame. So whatever you say will be taken on board, but you can engage with Office of the AG, and they'll tell you who, and Advocate Fatima and her team, and it will be helpful to us.
All right, ma'am, we'll give you 5 minutes to wrap up.
Well, then perhaps I should just go. Would you like to ask me questions, Chair, on what I've written that you have before you? You know, that may be the most obvious solution rather than... mine was too ambitious,
yeah,
in the sense that I was trying to alert you to the possibility that there are inconsistencies.
All right.
And wishing to assist.
Let's do as we've done before. Singh, there's only two of us, others have left because they'll be coming back, by the way, they've gone to... So about the engagement of Parliament. Singh and then Honourable McLaughlin.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted more clarity on your reference to Schedule 2 of the public entity, the PFMA, because a number of the other public entities are listed in Schedules 3, 4, and 5, but I appreciate that they are not comprehensive. So maybe as we move forward, you know, we will have to ask the Office of the Auditor General, because there's about 700 of them, I think, as far as I know. To what extent, you know, are all being audited, and should they all have been listed here in the PFMA? Because item 20 on Schedule 2 says any subsidiary or entity under the ownership control of the above public entity. So I don't know if that covers the whole lot, but we've got to see whether this list is comprehensive enough. And I think I take the point that, you know, we really got to impress upon our Finance Committee members to look at this Act, you know, and see whether it's relevant and to what extent it needs to be amended in light with the current developments in our country. So just on the public entities. Thanks.
Honourable McLaughlin.
Thank you, Chair. I would not be pertinent to ask Dr. Naidoo at this point, but I would just like to thank her for what she has done in any event. It's appreciated. Thank you.
All right. Again, and the AG will... First of all, I think we need to get a presentation. You know, I'm reading your email, I think dated the 19th of February. It says, somewhere there, it says, all public entities should be audited by the Auditor General. That is all well and good, but that comes with capacity implications. And that is why I'm saying we would need to look at that. Because I was saying to people prior to you coming, but this doesn't apply to the Auditor General. When we make such suggestions, I'm not saying you, if we're saying, and then we're talking about the Attorney General, I think, up the capacity, which he or she must do in Auditor General case also, but at the same time there's somebody else that says, but your wage bill is too high. So there's always those balancing acts that we have, including the AG. His report that the Parliament passed, we accepted your suggestion, AG, that you're going to reduce your staff by 54, if you recall what you said just in the strat plan. That's now what Parliament has said. But if you do this, it means you'll have to come back to us and say to us, please give me permission to employ 154 more people. So do you understand what I'm saying, Honourable Member, AG, and also to you, Doc? Is that these things are, I suppose they're easy to put on here, but when you look at the practical reality, it's problematic. I don't know, AG, if you can audit in your current capacity, if you could audit all these. Is this thing something we all want it to happen? Is it practical? I'm not asking you to answer, but I'm saying these are the kinds of things, Dr. Naidoo, that I think it would be useful if you gave us the information. So that some of them we could say to you up front, yes, like these young ladies said earlier on, yes, we all want it, but you know what, it's not going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen for these reasons. Yes, we like it, but it's not possible for those reasons. So please give us your submissions. We will, through Cindy, decide whether it should be dealt with by the technicians, whether it should be dealt with by us, whether we should interact with you in writing. But I think all that information, as AG has said, is always useful. Even to us as oversight bodies, it's useful that we know what is happening on the ground or what should be happening on the ground. So other than the question that Honorable Singh is asking and the question that I'm asking, is it feasible for the AG to do all the audits that we think he should be doing? We all agree he should be doing them. Is it feasible at this point in time, or are you saying it's something that we should consider as a nice, not a nice to have, but something that we should consider going forward? Because I think there's agreement on it, just about the how. Now those are the only questions, and then we'll hand over to our, thank you very much for waiting for us, Western Cape. Thanks, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. I do believe it's feasible because Section 4.3 is very, very clear. You see, the Auditor General may audit and report on the accounts, financial statements, and financial management. And then if you take another section here, the provision, so that is where the opt-out clause is that I'm referring to. But When you go to, is it section 12? I'm sorry, I need to get speaker. Where you describe authorized auditors. So the auditor general then can delegate that responsibility to an authorized auditor, which could be any auditor from the private sector. And it is the auditee who will pay for that. So the auditor general does not necessarily have to have the capacity. I'm just talking about the process where you are separating responsibilities of an accounting authority, and then put, because all the others, the government entities, the state-owned companies, they fall under the 4-1. So I'm just saying it's practical to put them all in the same category, and then you delegate the authority to whoever, and then the auditee pays for it. So the question of funding, I don't think, would be the big, great problem for the auditor general, or capacity for that matter, because you're simply delegating it to someone. With regard to Section 3A, yes, there are some entities like the National Housing Finance Corporation. That's a state-owned company. So you just have to pick up. You know, you have to keep going and looking. I'm merely saying, what about these entities who are registered with the Registrar of Public Entities? And there are hundreds of them. Those are the ones that are not covered by this Act at the moment, at the amendment. So, you know, that really needs to be looked into.
All right. If you could please interact with Cindy with the press, and I don't know, as you said, you're weighing on it, but at some point, like we said, if it could come to by Friday. So if you're going to write on the way home, write tonight, write tomorrow, as long as it gets us by Friday so that we can in turn look at it and give it to our colleagues, whoever they might be, that is going to assist us, it's fine. But please, if we could get it by lunchtime on Friday, so if we could get it by lunchtime on Friday, it would be helpful.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say that you know, it wasn't my intention to just present you with new information, but I wanted to expand on what I had already written, because I felt that was not sufficient. And I felt it would be better to do it at an oral one, and then you could ask me questions. Secondly, I prefer to have the exchange in writing. I'll submit whatever I have. It would be far better for me if any member has a query, any member of staff or the legal office or the Auditor General's office, I would do it by email. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, ma'am, and thanks for making the time. Much appreciated. Honorable Kahn.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Nader, I see your email address has been removed from what we have here. Is there an email address we could use to get in contact with you?
I will send it to
Cindy.
Oh, she has it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Cindy is asking, is it all right that she shares it with me?
Yes, but not
No, I'm saying with members of the committee.
Yes, of course. It's just that I've made many, many submissions over the years to different committees, and sometimes they're published on the internet. And I get, like this, for instance, on the sectional titles, Management Scheme Act, the CSOS Act, and I have people from around the country, thousands of people who write to me, you know, so I simply have to even block my Emirates account.
All right, over to you, ma'am, and your team. If there's any gaps that you have picked up so far, you could do that.
Okay, thank you,
Chairperson. Honourable members, you've got the presentation. It's a one-pager from...
No, Chairperson. With my submission, I'm basically...
Oh, it's 14. Oh, it's number 14, yeah.
Okay. Chairperson, I think quite a number of our areas were already addressed by the various presenters. Just one area that I want to give you attention. I have briefly discussed it with the AG. We clarified our comments on page 8 of our comments. It's given it related to page 8.
Yes.
We initially interpret this to be moving away from our existing practices of actually having an audit finding. My colleague
Page 8 of your report.
Of our report, yeah. So
six.
But the AG has subsequently during tea break clarified that that's not the intention with this proposed amendment to this particular bill. However, and I do have counts now. However, if I look at the comments made by Ms. LaRue, Leonard LaRue, in the fact.
Okay.
If you go to the last page, that deals with clause 6, it's opening words are the intention of the amendment.
She's talking to the microphone.
Oh, sorry. The intention of the amendment is to give the AG more flexibility for all purposes, you know, not to duplicate elections of individuals at higher risk. But if you look at the amendment itself, that intention doesn't come quite through.
If you look at our amendment, you talk about it like that.
Yes. So the, what the lady highlights here in this particular comment that she made, it's, I can't interpret it to be here in this particular amendment. And just touching on what my colleague said earlier on about drafting style, if that is the intention, the objective to remain this particular section, then say so. The AG may have the power to be selective. You know, that type of wording, instead of what we've got here, that's not reflective.
All right, I think we take that, but like we say to everybody else, would you suggest wording to us? If you would suggest wording to us, we will take it, give it to the AG as well before Friday, and give it to the drafting team, and they will then look at it, because like I said, we're not drafters, but if you get it to Cindy, as we said to the guys from Rand Water, please, we're not experts, if you give it to us, so that it's watertight going forward, we want it. Then welcome. Any comments, Honourable Members, on this? Welcome. We will take this on board.
Yeah, Chair, thank you. I see, ma'am, that you have made comments to 10 different clauses here. So you're comfortable with all the others? You don't want to expand on any of them?
The others
are too. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honourable Members, and our guests. For those that are interested, we are here tomorrow. And we're dealing in the main with local governments until lunch. Parking standards board, chartered accountants institutions, and ABASA, Association of Black Accountants. Those are the people we're dealing with tomorrow. And Institute for Internal Auditors, that's tomorrow as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure, sir.
All right. Once again, tomorrow we're working until lunchtime here, Honourable Members. The arrangements are the same. Transport for those that are coming here. AG, I would imagine you and your team will, or somebody from your team will be here. We're at the same venue tomorrow, also hoping to get out of here around about this time. And then Friday we're at the old assembly. Thank you very much, Honourable Members. The meeting stands adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.
Transport the outside. Yeah, okay, members just go straight there because transport is out here.
You mean you're not providing lunch?
No.
Cindy is mean. No lunch. No breakfast. No lunch. No,
there's something there. For tea
time. Ah,
tea time. I'm going to go to the